Good evening and welcome to the Arroyo Grande City Council meeting for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016. May we have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Here.
And Mayor Hill?
Here. Please join us in a moment of reflection and a moment of silence for the victims in Brussels, Belgium. Thank you. Tonight, to help us with the flag salute, Ann McCracken and Maureen Sharon are here from the Kiwanis Club. Will you please stand, and they'll lead us in the flag salute.
Place your hand over your heart, and let's re-pledge our allegiance to the greatest union in the world. That is the United States of America. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please be seated. Thank you, ladies. Would you like to tell us about some of the exciting events coming up, please?
Okay, how long do we have, Mayor? You know, the Arroyo Grande Valley Kiwanis Club came here last summer and asked for your support as we started our project of the all-access playground at Elm Street Park. Well, I just want to give you a very quick update. Diane's new, so she hasn't heard all this, but we'll get her up to speed really quickly. We are working on it. We're still working on our approach to the fundraising. We have a lot of support. Our goal is very small. It's only $18,000. So that said, we're rocking and rolling right there. And another really neat thing, Maureen's, I don't even know what she's got on her sheet because this was kind of impromptu, but we all have our special projects. We are a united, LUCMR is a united school district, right? We've got tens of schools in our district. And all of us try to sponsor a child Kiwanis Club, a Kiwanis Club that sponsors sponsored youth, and that's what we call it. Well, in Napomo, they have a really great high school, as you know, part of the LUCMR Unified School District, and they lost their sponsor. They have a key club, a very active key club. So this year, we were asked if we'd be interested in taking them under our wing. And Maureen's going to tell you more about that, but we did. And it's quite a project to work with a group that's in Napomo, and we're certainly up here. But we are the five cities, and that includes Napomo in our United, or LUCM, our United Unified School District. So we're honored to take them on. And there was one other important thing we're doing. Oh, my gosh. I'm wearing the hat to remind me. Seriously. The Harvest Festival. Now, we don't put on the Harvest Festival. The Harvest Festival is put on by the Arroyo Grande Harvest Festival Association, of which I happen to be the president again. So here I am to promote the Harvest Festival. Our Kiwanis Club puts on the parade. Rotary puts on a fish fry. We have so many things going on by nonprofit organizations, and it all comes back to our community to support our projects. So this hat is to remind me to remind you to please get behind us. Our first meeting is over at City Hall in the conference room upstairs. It's open to the public. Chris is on the committee. We've got all kinds of folks in here already involved in the association. Tomorrow night at 5:30, upstairs conference room at City Hall, our first meeting. Don't be afraid to put your feet in the water because we're really, really, really easy. Thank you. Go, Maureen.
Yeah, I'm just going to go give you a little background here. The Kiwanis Club of Arroyo Grande Valley was founded in July of 1973, so we've been around a little while. And Kiwanis' mission is to change the world one child and one community at a time. So our club has been trying very, very hard to make life better for everyone in the city of Arroyo Grande. To that end, we built and we maintain Kiwanis Park, where the roosters hang out, and I understand some guinea pigs too, and some cats, but also some people and families who enjoy picnicking there. We donate and collect books and donate them to local elementary school libraries to promote literacy. We sponsor and chair the Harvest Festival, as Anne was saying. This is her second year chairing the Harvest Festival, and I don't know how she does it, but she's perfect. She's perfect. She can juggle 150 balls and not drop any of them. I don't know how. We also do a lot of cotton candy sales. We help with cops and kids. We make cotton candy at all the Arroyo Grande High School home games, and all the proceeds of that go to help the band at Arroyo Grande High School. And our big once-a-year activity for the community is hosting 150 to 200 homebound senior citizens every year to a melodrama performance, thanks to the melodrama's generosity and their actors in doing a free performance. And the whole melodrama is filled with wheelchairs, and seniors are brought in vans. We rent vehicles. We do a huge performance. And this year, our Nipomo High School Key Club kids are going to be volunteering to help serve popcorn and soda. So we've got an awful lot going on. And I really want everybody here who's interested in helping us help our community. You help us, you help you, we help our whole community. Our meetings are every single Thursday morning from 7 to 8 a.m. So no excuse you won't miss work. We have a breakfast meeting. We're out by 8 o'clock. And we invite everybody to come. Join us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Ann. And thank you to all the Kiwanis members for all that you do for the community. For the agenda review, we have no closed session announcements this evening. Can we move that all the ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Tonight we have a few special presentations. The first is the Mayor's Commendation Recognizing New Life Painting, Paint It Forward. And John Rogers is here from city staff. If you'd like to please come up and tell us about this.
Thank you, Mayor Hill and council members. Before I talk a little bit about the program, the commendation, I'd just like to introduce Sheridan Bolkin, who is our volunteer coordinator. Sheridan, you wouldn't mind? There's Sheridan. Well, she has done a really terrific job since she started here as volunteer coordinator. The commendation tonight that you're going to be giving out is a testament to one of her first large-scale successes, and we know there's going to be a lot more to come. The commendation, New Life Painting Company has a program called Paint It Forward, which provides professional painting services for needy community projects. Co-owner Noah Winkles recently supplied a crew of professional painters to paint the interior of the Elm Street Community Center. And that included a donation of all of the painting supplies and the labor. This project gave the Elm Street Community Center a much-needed new sparkle, and it saved the city approximately $2,000. So it was a very, very generous donation. This time I'd like to go ahead and call Noah up. Sheridan? Before you give the official commendation, Sheridan has a little thank you from the children that use the Elm Street Community Center for Noah.
Thank you. Noah, this is on behalf of the children, the parents, and the staff that all utilize Elm Street Community Center and have so for years and now have a fresh new environment to walk into every day. Thank you.
So, Noah, this is a mayor's commendation recognizing New Life Painting, Paint It Forward. The city of Arroyo Grande recognizes and thanks New Life Painting for its generous donation of materials and labor to paint the inside of the Elm Street Community Center. And on behalf of the entire city council and city staff, I'd like to thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think this will work. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Mel. Really appreciate it. What a terrific program.
And item 6B is if David Wesolowski would come up.
Mr. Mayor, I was just notified that he is stuck in traffic, and so if we could maybe move forward with the next proclamation and come back to that.
Okay, we certainly can. Is Maddie Quaglino here? Yes, she is. Maddie, this is an honorary proclamation from the City of Arroyo Grande proclaiming April 2016 as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month, and April 9th, 2016 as Day of the Child. Whereas Saturday, April 9th, 2016 will commemorate the 38th annual Children's Day in the Plaza celebration in San Luis Obispo Mission Plaza. This year's celebration is in partnership with Arts Obispo's Passport to the Arts, where children and families will have the opportunity to discover creativity, individuality, diversity in the arts while exploring community resources. Whereas Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month is a time to recognize that children's opportunities are our responsibilities and to commit ourselves to ensuring that each and every child experiences a high-quality environment at home, at childcare, at school, and in the community that will promote their optimal development. Whereas every moment in a child's life is an opportunity for that child to learn, and that the quality of these experiences may determine whether a child succeeds in school and in life, and that all children need caring and loving adults in their lives. Whereas this month's activities will provide an opportunity to acknowledge youth and early care and education programs and their dedicated staff, and to raise the awareness of the community, employers, and elected officials of the need to improve the quality, availability, and accessibility of such programs. Whereas, may we remember to listen to and watch the children around us, to have patience, and to allow them the opportunity to enjoy the journey of childhood. Therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande hereby proclaims April 2016 as Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention Month, and April 9th, 2016 as Day of the Child. So I'd like to present this proclamation on behalf of the entire City Council and the City of Arroyo Grande. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Honorable Mayor and Council Members. Who I have with me this evening are children from our programs and graduate children of our programs, some of my staff and families. So we're very honored to receive this proclamation, and we hope the artwork that the children has made brightens up your chambers. And there's also gifts for you to enjoy just in case you need a snack. So there's a nice snack there for you, and on it has the reminder about Children's Day in the Plaza. So again, thank you for this opportunity to accept this proclamation on behalf of the San Luis Obispo Child Care Planning Council. And the Month of the Child and Child Abuse Prevention. So we're from Arroyo Grande United Methodist Children's Center. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary. So we were established September 2005, and we serve 50 families. And families from San Luis Obispo all the way down to Santa Maria. We've also served families as far north as Paso Robles. So this is a great site in Arroyo Grande. We're right off of Halcyon Street. And our niche in the community is that we provide a low ratio to our families. So it's a 4-to-1 ratio in our toddler program and a 6-to-1 ratio in our preschool and pre-K program. And we strive to provide the best of quality through following the standards
by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. And we are participating in their accreditation process. So we are working very hard with continued education and following quality standards for the best of care for the families in our community. We also provide wonderful activities for our families. We have activities monthly that happen, whether they're fundraisers or socials or just informational. So what's coming up here shortly in April for Month of the Child, we're having an open house, and that's on April 14th from 6:30 to 7:30. So the whole community is welcome to come and see what we have to offer. And also on Sunday, on April 24th from 10:30 to 12:30, we're having an ice cream social and children's silent auction. And it's a wonderful opportunity to see the beautiful artwork that the children do. And we do follow the masters, and so we're doing a study on the masters right now at our school. So, and that's, just a lot of masters. So, Andy Warhol, Kandinsky, and Monet, and all of those. So, the masters. But anyway, it's a great study, and the children are loving it. So, you can follow us on Facebook. We have a community outreach where friends from the community will come. And like we have the fire department, the police department, the ambulance came, and also we'll bring fun to the school like we have this month is down on the farm. And so each week we have different farm animals coming and seeing the children, and that's been lots of fun. So you can follow all the fun on Facebook. And our website is agumcc.org. Pretty easy. Come and see us.
Thank you, Patty, and thank you for bringing our future city leaders. We appreciate it. Okay. Next item then is 6D, Jerry Rio for
I have a slideshow.
It's a PDF, so just...
Yeah, so it'd be one page at a time.
Yeah, this area.
This will be a presentation by the Homeless Services Oversight Council on housing, diversity, and options.
Right. Thank you. That does sound on okay. Let's see how this goes. This is a slide presentation that was done by the Housing Committee of HSOC. I'm on the Housing Committee. Its purpose is to educate, develop some consistent vocabulary, increase the understanding of housing challenges facing our community, and inspire people to think of flexible and innovative solutions. That's much better. Why are alternatives needed? As you all know, we have a housing crisis in this county. More than 1,500 people sleep in their cars, on the street, in the bushes every night. If you look at the percentage of our population countywide that is homeless, it's larger than the percentage of the population in LA County. And 2 years ago, it was higher than San Francisco even. We have a tremendous problem with homelessness, and that results from the fact that we have such a tight housing market. California is one of the tightest housing markets, and in 2013, our county had the lowest vacancy rate for rental housing in the whole state at 1.7%, and the standard is usually 5 to 6%. Along with that, the National Association of Home Builders ranks and has consistently ranked our county the 11th least affordable in the country, and that's out of 200 and some odd metro areas. So there's a big problem. It creates a housing affordability crisis and increases homelessness. There are a lot of reasons for the problems. Part of it's changing demographics. We have fewer families, more single households. Millennials are, their lifestyle and their life patterns are changing. And we also have the sharing economy, which is both an opportunity and a challenge. In addition, we have groups that need special support. People who have mental health challenges, physical challenges, medically fragile individuals, youth who are on their own with no support, elderly who are becoming, like myself, more frail all the time, and folks who are in recovery. There are a number of reasons why we can't change the situation quickly. Among them are zoning codes and other development codes that have been developed over the years, and the lack of infrastructure is particularly important in our county. We don't have water or sewer to do a lot of development. And then we also have the social barriers of people not wanting more housing. A lot of people will tell you that they moved here from somewhere and don't want anyone else to move here. There are a lot of potential solutions, and we've focused on the ones that are more the low-hanging fruit. The first one is to approve more multifamily housing. I'm the director of the Housing Trust Fund, and we just financed the first apartment building in Arroyo Grande that's been built in over 20 years. There need to be more apartments. Arroyo Grande has some good mobile home parks, and they provide an affordable opportunity for people. More would be better. More granny flats or second units would be very helpful, whether it's cutting an apartment out of an existing house. We have a lot of large homes that are occupied by one person, and if they could divide the house up into two units, they could get income and provide housing for quite a few people. Garage apartments and cottages in the backyard are other examples. Right now we have, it's quite a fad, the tiny home movement, and that's something that we should look at. Both in communities like a mobile home park or a trailer park, but also the city of Fresno recently authorized the use of tiny homes as second units behind existing homes. So that's something that we could look at. Live-work opportunities are important because people can not only have their place of business, but live above the store or the office. One of the things that we really have a shortage of are residential hotels, which are often called SROs, and boarding houses. Years ago, they were very common. They're in either totally independent rooms or rooms that have shared bathrooms and kitchens. Some had facilities. If we could approve more of them, that would be helpful. Unfortunately, boarding houses are practically banned by most jurisdictions, and people have a hard time providing that opportunity. Another thing that's needed for special needs groups would be group homes. We financed, the Housing Trust Fund financed a small apartment project in Arroyo Grande for the Family Care Network, and they have foster care youth who are aging out of the system, so they're 16 to 21, and they live semi-independently in these apartments. They share them, and they get training and support so that they could become productive members of society. We also finance transitional housing for the Woman's Shelter Program in Grover Beach. There's also a need for both independent and assisted living, more institutional, but they're finding ways to make them feel more like homes so that people can live out their later years in relative comfort. There are a number of things that can be done that it's down to short-term options, but they can be permanent as well. Home sharing works, matching up a person who needs a home with someone who owns a home and has extra bedrooms, converting commercial buildings to residential, buying vacant units, rehabbing them. That's not as much an issue in our area, but in many areas there are vacant units that bring down the neighborhood, and if they could be purchased and upgraded, they would help. Home shares, conversions of old motels, using them as permanent housing, conversion of commercial structures in inappropriate areas or districts that are no longer viable. Really going through this. So providing options requires leadership and action. Individuals in the community need to show their commitment and their support for more affordable housing for our community. The leadership of the city needs to, and so does the staff. Right now, it's really appropriate that later today you're going to have a hearing on the housing element, which is where a lot of the housing policies take place. And so I'd like to encourage you to think about these ideas that we presented today and encourage things that will help produce affordable housing that's compatible with your neighborhoods. So that's the presentation and my first time through, so I hope it wasn't too rough or too long. If there are any questions, I'd entertain questions.
Questions for
Sarah?
Yeah. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you very much.
As Mr. Wasilowski would come up, please. We have a proclamation. Welcome. This is a mayor's commendation presented to Sprinkler King Incorporated. The City of Arroyo Grande recognizes Sprinkler King Incorporated for conducting over 150 residential and commercial irrigation surveys and performing numerous irrigation retrofits throughout the city since 2009. This effort has resulted in an estimated water savings of 62 acre-feet per year, which is the equivalent of providing water for 188 homes each year. The city sincerely appreciates Sprinkler King Incorporated for helping the city to conserve its precious water resources in times of a serious and ongoing drought. So on behalf of this entire city council and city, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your efforts. Moving on to item 7 is community comments and suggestions. Any member of the public may address the council on any item that is not on the agenda this evening. For those items that are on the agenda this evening, we would ask that you please hold comment, and we will have individual public comment on each item as it is taken up by the council. So this is an opportunity, if there are items within the city's purview that is not on the agenda this evening you'd like us to know about, please feel free to come up at this time. Ms. Osti.
Good evening, Mayor, City Council members, and also staff. Thank you. Compassionate God and Father of all, we are horrified at the violence in so many parts of the world, especially the act of violence in Brussels earlier today. Let us honor the 31 victims in today's attack in Brussels. Pray for the victims and their families as they struggle with this senseless act of violence. Let us also pray for the dozens of victims and their families injured in today's attack. It seems that none are safe, and some are terrified. Hold back the hands that kill and maim. Turn around the hearts that hate. Grant instead your strong spirit of peace that passes our understanding but changes lives. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Thank you. And I'd also like to announce that the Pismo Beach Five Cities Rotary Club is having our annual golf tournament. It's for our foundation. It's the only fundraiser we do for the foundation, and it benefits local scholarships. So if anyone's interested, it's at the Country Club, and you can either play or you can do a tea sponsor for $100 or come for dinner and enjoy the company. Thank you very much. Let me know if you're interested. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to comment at this time?
Good evening. Mary Giambalvo, proud and windblown resident of Arroyo Grande for 59 years. I am on the steering committee of Arroyo Grande in Bloom, which is a local nonprofit that takes care of the potted plants, the baskets, parks, some of the parks. And we have a great relationship with the city, who come and pick up our giant burlaps of weeds and trimmings. But what I'd like to mention now is that America in Bloom, the national organization, has asked us to host their national symposium and awards this year. It's a great honor, a tough one, but a great one, in that we are the smallest city to ever host. We're following Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Hershey, Pennsylvania, St. Louis, and on and on and on. And we are also the first city west of the Mississippi to have this honor. And we will need volunteers in October. It'll be the first in the first week of October, and we would love to have you because we want to showcase our beautiful city to almost 200 people who will be coming from all over the country. I would like to single out three people: that Kristen Barnich, who's a council member who is on the Tree Guild and has cooperated and worked with us, and also to council member Jim Guthrie and City Manager Diane Thompson, who have enthusiastically come to our meetings and are supporting us in every way. And I thank you all for what you have done and what you're going to do.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to address the council at this time?
Thank you. Down. Okay. Good evening, council members. Ladies and gentlemen, at the City Council meeting on March 8th, the Council approved an allocation of funds for CDGB projects for 2016. The SLO NOR Foundation was one of the beneficiaries of a grant from these funds. Dr. Ahmad Norstani, founder of NOR Foundation, its board of directors, and all of us at the NOR Clinic would like to thank you for this grant. We know that many organizations applied for funding and appreciate how difficult it must have been to allocate funds available to you. The SLO NOR clinics provide free medical, dental, and eye care to uninsured adults regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, immigration, or socioeconomic status. In most cases, those without health insurance forego seeing a doctor. If they do seek medical care, their only health care option is an emergency room, which can drain financial resources in our community. For every dollar the SLO NOR clinic receives, we are able to provide almost $100 in free medical services. This grant will help the clinic provide ongoing exams, medical services, dental care, eye treatments, and glasses to our patients who otherwise could not afford health care. Thank you again for your grant.
Thank you for all that the NOR Foundation does.
Thank you, dear.
Would anyone else like to address the council at this time? Items that are not on the agenda.
I was contacted by Marguerite Botter, the president of the League of Women Voters, because Miss Jarrett had called her the day after the last meeting, and Miss Bader had decided to watch the meeting. She profusely apologized for how Devin Ward was treated and Miss Jarrett's comments and speaking out of order. We also spoke about the disruption near the end of the meeting, and she stated she could clearly hear me say, "Don't touch me like that," and wanted my side of things, then apologized because somebody felt they could but physically try to restrain me. We also chatted about Devin Ward and the need to pass an ordinance in the very near future to help residents in the need of medical cannabis. We spoke about the sanitation district and some of the other meetings I attend in the area that affect the city. Last night, Ms. Linden brought up about the elephant in the room and how some citizens are acknowledged by staff and others are not. Some get appointments with the city managers, others don't. I could go on and on about the distinct differences of treatment. I have to say, I did notice that some of the people who got up and spoke were not even residents of our city, and we rarely ever see them at council meetings. I believe we all want what is best for our city, and the difference is what we consider best to be. I would love to see more residents involved, as I see that as a good thing. One resident got up and stated the city council meetings used to be fun. I've been coming to council meetings on and off for over 10 years, and I can say I've never considered them fun. I did not think it was fun to find out the city had over $17 million of unfunded PERS liability that did not show up on our books. The millions we have spent on Briscoe Halcyon and with no real changes. That we have lost a major grocery store and it appears the city is doing little to anything to get another one in town. It was not fun to see that we are spending more than we take in revenue. Some businesses are made to follow municipal codes and others are not. That we have businesses leaving our town to do business elsewhere. That is not fun to hear. We need more residents to be involved with the city, to come to meetings to help our city grow and prosper. We need more revenue for the city, and until we start treating all businesses the same, we are only hurting ourselves. We need this council to start working together like you were doing when Bob McFaul was here. I look forward to being on the League of Women Voters and helping the city move forward and hopefully see more residents attend meetings and getting involved. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Would anyone else like to address the council this evening? Okay, hearing none at this time. Please come forward.
First, I was hoping somebody else would go between me and her. Because I'm not as obsessed she is. Can you hear me? Is that?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, that's fine.
I've got to turn my clock on or I'm going to go over. My name is Chris Haggerty. I live here in Rio Grande. And I've been meaning to come talk to you guys about the housing situation. And with our friend here talking tonight, I thought this would be a good time. I'm not associated with him. He gave a great talk. But what I am, I'm a person that's lived here all my life, and about 8 years ago, I got real sick, became disabled, and I've been having a real tough time. I live on Social Security disability. I live with different people. I try to make things work. According to what a lot of people say is homeless, I am technically homeless. I don't have a home. I live with different people. And I'm very close to... within months, I could easily be homeless living in my van on the street. Mainly because we don't build housing for people like me. We build a lot of housing for families, for agricultural families, for multi-room apartments all over the place. The longest waiting list in this area are for single-room apartments because I can't have a multi-room. I don't need one, don't get me wrong. But I can't go into a multi-room apartment. I'm not qualified for that. Couples cannot go into a multi-room apartment because they're not qualified for that. They have to get a studio or a single-room apartment. We don't build those. We keep building structure after structure, facility after facility, all over the place. There's about 6 single-room apartments in the 5 cities in the people's self-help housing thing. And I'm not upset with people's self-help housing. They do what they do very, very well. Their whole mission in life is to provide housing for agricultural families. Okay? Basically, they're a wonderful fish that somebody came along and said should be frogs. They're not built to do what we do, what I need. Okay? I contacted last year, I think it was last year, both Tim Brown and Barbara Harmon. Both helped me out a lot, as much as they could. It's not a contest. Tim got further. He actually, somebody came out to meet me and everything. But they both went above and beyond and tried to help out. And honestly, there just was nowhere they could go with it, okay? There's nothing for me to get to. I've been on a wait list for 3 years. My next step is probably to either accept I need to move to a Tascadero, where they build lots of single-room apartments, tons of them, because they're more worried about their citizens living there right now. And it's not, they're not bad people. I don't think anybody's thought about this in the past. No one's talked about this. No one's saying, well, what about all these people? I don't want to move to a Tascadero. I like it here. My power structure's here. My friends are here. Oh, is that my full 3 minutes? Okay, cool. Because my scouts will tell you, I run along all the time. Anyway, I hope I got my point across. I'm not angry with anybody, but this is a problem. This is a big problem. There's lots of people like me. There's people living in borrowed motorhomes at the beach because they can't get housing and beating cancer while they're doing it. Okay? These people around need help. I need help. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, and thank you for your comment. Would anyone else like to address the council at this time? Okay, hearing none, we'll then close public comment and move on to item 8, which is our city manager's report. City Manager Thompson.
Good evening, Muriel and City Council. First, a water update for you. We continued to meet our water conservation goals in February. We were 33% below our water use for the same time period in 2013. And Shane Taylor, utilities manager, provided me with some statistics for the city's per capita daily water use for the last 3 years that I thought might be of interest to you. In 2013, we used 164 gallons per day per person. In 2014, it was 144 gallons per day per person. And in 2015, we're at 117 gallons per day per person. So we're doing really well in terms of water conservation, and our residents are to be congratulated. Wanted to mention the Spring Fun Family Tea Party that took place last Saturday. 75 parents and children attended this first annual event. It was held at the Women's Club. Activities included balloon animals, face painting, a raffle, photos with the Easter Bunny, music, and a silent auction, which raised more than $1,000. There were dignitaries in attendance, including Mayor Hill, Mayor Pro Tem Harmon, Parks and Recreation Commissioner Linda Sandy, and of course the Easter Bunny. The participants enjoyed tea sandwiches, lemonade, and dessert, and our recreation coordinator Carrie Van Beveren did an outstanding job of organizing this new event along with many volunteers. We have another holiday event coming up this coming Saturday, which is our 27th annual Family Egg Hunt and Festival, and it's held at Elm Street Park beginning at 10 a.m., and I was advised to get there early because parking is scarce. It's a very popular event. More than 25,000 candy or prize-filled plastic eggs will be gathered in seven different age groups, including a special adult category. The Oceano Five Cities Elks Lodge is donating $2,500 to cover the cost of hot dogs, chips, and punch that will be provided at no cost to the public. And the event is expected to draw about 2,000 participants, so another very popular event. I wanted to let you know about some upcoming council agenda items. The medical marijuana item that you asked to come back with modifications to allow some limited personal cultivation as well as delivery is scheduled to come back tentatively in late May or June. And since there are only two other cities in California that currently have regulations for delivery of medical marijuana, we don't have a lot of templates to borrow from. So we're having to do the research thoroughly to bring something back to you which is appropriate for our city. On April 12th, we've tentatively scheduled a discussion of traffic calming measures, and also at that meeting we're going to be discussing the Five Cities Fire Authority, JPA, Joint Powers Authority Agreement, and some amendments to that agreement. And then on April 26th at that council meeting, we're trying to keep our agenda free except for a topic on water to give you an update on where we stand with our water use restrictions and an update on drought conditions. So that will be the theme for that meeting. And lastly, I wanted to tell you about something we're doing as part of our efforts in supporting small business. We're organizing a free workshop next month, which is called Google Plus Yelp. And this workshop will focus on how to use Google to help your customers find you and how to use Yelp to improve your business. There will also be information on using Facebook, Instagram, and other social media for businesses, and general information on services that are available to small businesses. The presentation will take place at noon here in the council chambers on April 21st, and lunch will be served. That's the first hour of the workshop. It will be informational. The second hour of the workshop, for those who wish to remain, will include one-on-one assistance in setting up a Google profile for your business on your laptop. So we're hoping participants will bring their laptops, and we'll provide the training to help them develop that Google profile the second hour of the workshop. And we're putting this workshop on in conjunction with a number of partners, which include the Arroyo Grande Grover Beach Chamber of Commerce, the Hot House in SLO, SCORE, the Women's Business Center, and Cuesta, and many thanks to Cuesta College for covering the cost of the workshop. This exciting workshop replaces a workshop that we previously had scheduled in February, which was on search engine optimization, and that was canceled, unfortunately, due to lack of interest. But we're hoping, with a great program lined up with a number of partners, hands-on training, and free food, that this will be a successful event. And for more information, please check the city's website next week. That concludes my report, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Item 9 is the consent agenda. Are there any items that we would like to consider separately?
I'd like to consider 9K.
Okay. Any others?
I don't want to pull it, but I just have a question on our clarification on 9G.
The kitchen project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We can certainly have a question on that.
You want to do that now?
Yes.
Okay. I just had a question. I spoke with John on the phone earlier today about the reallocation of the $40,000. Is he? Oh, hi, John. Quick question, just in case someone else read the staff report and had the same question. If we go ahead and reallocate the $40,000 to the upgrade for the kitchen at the community center, that takes us $5,000 or $10,000 over what we think it will cost, and then we're going to go ahead and put an RFP out for that, but we still have kind of $10,000. We have room there. John, is that right?
Yes, the math would be that there would be $115,000 in the funds. The guesstimate, I guess you could say, right now would be that it's $105,000, but that gives us $10,000 for contingency plus if our value engineering wasn't quite accurate and that it would cost a little bit more. So that's having that extra $10,000 would be appropriate.
That's my only question. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments? I've looked at item 9I, which is the standard specifications and engineering specifications. And even for a readaholic such as myself, I've not been able to get through the entire thing in the last couple days. I'm wondering if we can, is there a particular rush on that, or can we table that to the next meeting?
As far as I know, we can table it. It may not be the next meeting. We'll have to look at the agenda for the next meeting and see where we can fit it in. But if you'd like to continue that item to another meeting, we can certainly do that.
I would request council's indulgence to table this one meeting to be able to finish the major tome there.
Well, I would support that.
Sure.
Okay. In that case, I'll remove item 9I and ask that that be tabled.
You need to vote to continue that.
All in favor of tabling?
Aye.
Okay, unanimously. So, any other items then besides item 9K to be considered separately? Is there public comment on the consent agenda items, all except item 9K?
Good evening. My name is April McLaughlin. Mine is more a comment that as you approve the warrants, to just be aware that the tourism committee hasn't met since October, but we have almost $10,000 that we're approving on the warrants tonight. I just would like you guys to be aware of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to comment on the consent agenda items? Okay, hearing none at this time. Is there a motion?
I move approval of items 9A through 9J of the consent agenda.
With the exception of 9I, which has been...
I'm sorry, 9I. With the exception of 9I, which has been tabled. Okay, thank you.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. May we have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes. And I'd like Mayor Pro Tem Harmon to announce item 9K.
Yes, this is a consideration of council appointment to the Traffic Commission. And I just wanted to take a moment to introduce Susan Henslin. Susan is here tonight, joining us this evening to our Traffic Commission. She has resided in Rio Grande for 47 years. She brings to the commission a background in commercial real estate banking with an MBA with a concentration in management and leadership. So I would just like to thank her for stepping up to serve our community.
Thank you very much. And with that, I would move approval of item 9K.
Second.
Is there any further public comment on that? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Mayor Hill?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Item 10 is public hearings, and I'll request the city clerk to please announce the item.
Item 10A is consideration of requests from South County Sanitary Service for integrated solid waste collection rate increase.
We have the staff report.
Good evening, Mayor, members of council. I'm Debbie Malico, the Director of Administrative Services, tonight to talk about the solid waste collection service rates. Just a quick history of how we've got to this point. In July, the city received the request from the South County Sanitary Company for the base year increase to their rates of 3.25%, and also a proposal for the increases in the following two interim years. In October, on the 13th of 2015, we had a public hearing to consider that rate increase. At that meeting, we discovered that there were some discrepancies in the Proposition 218 notice. There were also some concerns about the calculation that determines if rate increases have exceeded the cumulative CPI and findings that might need to be made on behalf of the council. And so that meeting ended up being continued until tonight so that we could provide some proper noticing with the correct rates to the community. Just a quick review of that base rate increase. About a third of it is based on increases to things like fuel and vehicles and maintenance, labor, general increases to the cost of doing business. 0.81% of that 3.25% increase is based on a change to the cost of providing tipping fees, as they're called, at the landfill. This is an increase to deliver waste to Cold Canyon Landfill. It's going to go up by $2.25 per ton, and that's based on an agreement that Cold Canyon Landfill has with the county. It's a 9-year agreement, and it's a phased-in increase to help pay for an expansion at the landfill. And then again, about a third of the increase is going to be based on implementing a new organics program. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So that's the 3.25% increase that's in front of you. There's also a request by this trash company to do a multi-year rate setting approach, which we've not done before, but is something that would allow us to adopt tonight a methodology that would tell us what the increases would be over the next 2 years, and then we would not need to do interim year reviews because we would have already approved what those rate increases would be. There's two factors that would go into the changes to rates in 2017 and 2018. One factor is CPI. How does the general cost of consumer goods in the United States change? We don't know what that is yet because it's based on a period of time that hasn't yet occurred. But whatever that change in CPI is, and then we know what the changes will be for the tipping fees at Cold Canyon based on the 9-year agreement that the county has with Cold Canyon Landfill. So those two factors would combine to tell us how much the rate would increase in 2017 and 2018. I don't anticipate that those would be large increases. The last CPI was less than 1%. In fact, it was almost zero. So you're kind of looking at, you know, that you're going to have a 0.79 or 0.77% increase and probably a very small CPI factor. I would anticipate these are probably going to be less than the 3.25% increase that is in the base year. But I don't predict what the CPI is, so it could be something different. The organics program that is being proposed is based on Assembly Bill 1826. It requires us to divert organic waste from going to the landfill, and instead it has to go to an authorized composting facility. In this county, we have a plan that the countywide, that composting facility in the long term would be a new anaerobic digestion plant that would be located in San Luis Obispo on the Waste Connections property. It's the first one of its kind in the United States, so it's kind of exciting that we would be charting some new territory there. But it's a technology that's been around for many years in Europe. This is how the county, on a countywide basis, would deal with our organics program. That is scheduled to begin in 2017, the middle of 2017. So part of the rate increase is to deal with the implementation of this new organics program. The agreement that we have with South County Sanitary is a franchise agreement, and it governs how rates can be increased. It provides language that the council has an option to terminate that agreement if they feel that the rate increases have been too high. And by too high, we mean if they've exceeded the cumulative change in CPI since the inception of the agreement. So one of the calculations that we do in determining whether the requested rate increase is within that CPI change, in that calculation, not every cost is factored in. So while we do have some a trigger, if you will, to engage in an option that would say, hey, rates are too high, they've exceeded what we believe would be reasonable, they've exceeded the cumulative CPI changes, not every cost or rate increase goes into that calculation. And that's based on the agreement that we have with South County Sanitary. Earlier, just a few minutes ago, one of the things that you took up tonight was item 9C, which was an amendment to that agreement that basically says that one of the costs that we will exclude from that calculation is the increase in tipping fees associated with the landfill expansion. That $225 per ton for the next 9 years that we know is going to happen, that's going to be what's already been approved by the county as the increase to the tipping fees, we're not going to count those increases towards the calculation of whether or not we've exceeded the CPI. It's very similar to what we did a couple of years ago on another increase with the South County Sanitary related to green waste. As a reminder, the city did contract with Bill Statler to review the rate application made by South County Sanitary. He presented his findings back in October on the 13th, and those findings haven't changed. Essentially, when he reviewed the financial information and looked at the allowable costs and the pass-through costs and the amount of allowable profit by the company, he concluded that there could be an allowed revenue increase of 3.67%. South County Sanitary is asking for 3.25%. So the request that they're asking for is less than they could ask for, but it is reflective of their current costs that they foresee. The conclusions of his report were that the costs are reasonable, that the proposed rate increase meets the reasonable return criteria that's identified in our financial or in our franchise agreement, and that, again, that the requested rate of 3.25% is slightly less than the allowed increase of 3.67. So tonight, the recommendation that you have is adopting a resolution establishing the rates that begin April 1st, and then again, if you're so inclined to look at that multi-year strategy, what would the rates, the increases that would take effect January 1st of 2017, January 1st of 2018. This is a public hearing, so prior to the meeting tonight, I'll confirm with the city clerk, but I believe we had 5 protests. We have not received any additional protests to the rate increase, but people have until the close of the public hearing to turn in those protests if they had any. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for staff? Okay, Kristen?
Debbie, and maybe the applicant can answer this or can expand on it. The letter that we received from Mr. Duffin regarding the vacant rate, I talked a little bit to you about it over the phone to you, and have we always had that vacant rate? That's not anything new. I see that it's going up from 1074 to 1109, but that's something that the city's always, well, not the city, but the trash companies had that rate, and then you remember that being in effect?
I don't know that it's always been there, but it's been there for more than 20 years in the research that we looked at with the franchise agreements that we had with the South County Sanitary. It is a common industry standard rate that is charged when a home may not have active service needs, but would be vacant for some period of time, but would expect that at some period in the future they would need to re-engage the services. So it's not something new or different. It's not something that Arroyo Grande does that no one else does. It's very industry standard. It's been around more than 20 years, has increased as the rates have increased over time.
Okay. Can I ask you a quick question if you'd come to the microphone, please? Regarding the vacant
rate. Pat Fenton, South County. Yes, ma'am.
Regarding the vacant rate, can you explain the justifications for that? And then also, I know some utility companies have, they allow you to turn off your utilities, but then when you turn them back on, there's a startup rate. So do you, when you have service that's changed over to a new owner of a property, do you have a startup rate, or you just sort of continue the service, either a vacant rate or the rates for the trash cans?
I'm going to understand, because I just got this today from Debbie, a part of it is there's a vacancy rate, and then it will slightly increase to like a full service rate when we bring the cans back. And this vacancy rate was done, the garbage company didn't come up with this. The city council did it many years ago. I don't know exactly when. But that's to keep the cost down throughout the city. So there are people having different reasons why they didn't want to have the full rate, and that's why it was adopted. But to answer your question, the vacancy rate just goes up a little bit when the cans get delivered.
No, okay. Well, let me think about that. If someone else has a question that relates to that same line of questioning.
Well, since we're on the subject, I'm just curious about, you said the city council adopted it.
Is it something that you find necessary as part of your process?
I wasn't here when that was years ago, so I don't know what drove that discussion. From what I understand, you know, I checked with my predecessor. It was done because if somebody was having a second home or they were building their property and they decided that they weren't going to provide, you know, garbage, pretty much it was tied to the water rate. If you had your water on, then you were paying the garbage rate at the same time. In this particular question, this house is being refurbished, from what I understand, and the water is on. So, and there's some type of trash, but that's the only one I know of, and that's why the vacancy rate was put in place years ago for situations like this. Like if you go on an extended vacation, are you going to apply, say, well, I don't need to have my garbage picked up, and then you have people going on vacation in second homes, it would be pretty hard to control something like that. I think that's why it was adopted.
Mr. Mayor, I might be able to add just a little bit to the conversation. In our municipal code, we do have a section governing disposal service, and disposal of solid waste is mandatory from all developed properties in the city, and it benefits all occupants of developed properties in the city. So under our municipal code, we require that all developed properties use the city's solid waste collection and disposal service. So it is included in our municipal code. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you. We'll have public comment in just a moment after the council's questions.
In addition, if I could, Mayor, it's not dissimilar to water and sewer, where you have a large amount of infrastructure that needs to be provided to the community, regardless of how much water is used or waste is disposed of. There's a certain amount of fixed cost that it needs to be borne by the entire community to have these types of services. So we don't buy a trash truck because I want service today, and then I say, I don't want service for some period of time, and we'll sell the trash truck and we'll buy another one when I decide that I want my service back. It doesn't work that way. So there's a large amount of investment that has to happen just to provide the service to the community. So it is not dissimilar to what we do with water and sewer, in that there's a fixed component, if you will, to those services to help recoup those fixed costs, and then there's that variable component depending upon the actual delivery of service. So very similar concept.
Are there further comments? Councilmember Barnage, did you have other
questions? Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
I have questions for staff, and then I also have questions. A question for the applicant. My questions are staff. First start on page one of the staff report, and they're related to how the increases to the tipping fees are being calculated. I don't know if it's some big long trigonometry, you know, equation or something like that. But I was just curious how those are, you know, derived.
Increases to the tipping fee are governed by the county,
okay.
So I would have to defer to South County Sanitary to talk about what the trigonometry is that goes into calculating those with the county, and what the agreement that they have with the county, what that would look like.
Okay, then I'll hold that question for the applicant then. And then the only other question I had, I think you already explained this in your presentation, but to clarify, when I was reviewing the staff report, there was discussion about the landfill expansion, and then there was also talk about a new plant. And so I just wanted to clarify that the expansion that we're talking about, there is a landfill expansion going on, which has the 9-year incremental increase that the county has already moved forward on. And then there's a separate project to actually assist in this anaerobic digestion plant for our new organic waste program that they're required to do. So those are two different things. The thing we're discussing is really related to that landfill expansion, correct?
Correct. They are two different things. I wouldn't say that we're not discussing the compogas or anaerobic digester plant, that is 1.1% of the 3.25% increase that's in front of us. But they are two completely separate components. One deals with the capacity that Cold Canyon Landfill has. The other is the anaerobic digester plant that will deal with the organics and the food waste products.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification. I have nothing further. Just for the applicant. But we'll
Councilmember Guthrie.
I don't have any other questions.
Kind of along the lines of Barbara's questions, I go to these meetings and I'm part of the board, and the question I have is about the compogas aspect of it. You said it was 1%?
About 1.1%
yeah.
of the 3.25.
I was under the impression, and maybe the folks can come up and tell me I'm wrong if I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that part of the compogas calculation was to come to the jurisdictions and ask for extended length of a contract so that the compogas project would be affordable. And I don't want to get into that discussion tonight other than to say that's part of the calculation. So why are we voting on a 1% increase to cover that when we haven't dealt with the bigger issue of the increased length of contract?
It is two separate issues. The increased length of contract that South County Sanitary and Waste Connections has asked for to guarantee that they will have a 20-year waste stream that would go into the compogas facility.
I guess the question is I don't know what's going to happen. I'm assuming they're going to get it. Maybe you can answer this question, but there wouldn't be a point in giving a 1% increase if it's not in tandem with approving the longer contract, because if the longer contract doesn't happen, I assume compogas is not going to build the plant. So,
well, either way, we have to process the organics. The organics, the long-term plan is compogas, and before that, we use an Angling Gray in Santa Maria. So it's a short-term plan, and then the long-term plan.
So the 1% could be for going to Santa Maria just as much as compost.
Right, we're going to have to process the green waste anyway. So it's the big plan is to go long term, but okay. we're ready to start with this. That's what the increase
okay.
is for.
Okay, that answers the question. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Questions for the applicant?
I have two. And sorry I didn't catch it before you sat down. I don't know if you have the answer to how the tipping fees are being calculated. If someone wants to tackle that.
Hi, Bruce Brassfield, the controller. It's not trigonometry, or it's just simple math.
Oh, I'm glad.
No, it's an agreement that the county and the landfill had okay. come to set on how to pay for the expansion. And that's the county has agreed to, you know, over the next 9 years, pass a rate increase on to help cover those expansion costs.
Okay. And then the last question I have, I also have the same curiosity, but we did receive five letters, two of them, one from Mr. Bill Cockshaw and one from Ms. Linda Gross, specifically question: with the decline in fuel prices, how can increase in costs for fuel be a justification for a rate increase? And then this one is actually a direct quote from Ms. Gross, indicating why are solid waste disposal rates not being reduced based on the current sizable reduced costs, quote, you are incurring for fuel? So I didn't know if anyone from the applicant end had kind of a comparison for us. We do see the fluctuation of fuels going up and down, but clearly there's at least two residents that are kind of equating how could that be part of your justification, and didn't know if you had a response for them.
It's an operations and maintenance cost and labor cost. You know, they're all, the fuel is just a small portion. It does go up and down, but, you know, our insurances have gone up for our people when it, you know, like the Obamacare stuff. There's all kinds of things that are tied in. That's what Bill Statler went into a deep dive into those numbers. So it's kind of encompassing. So it's really operations, maintenance, labor, all these different things that are encapsulated. But fuel is a small component of it, but real, real small compared to some of the other pieces.
Do you know about how many trucks you're going to be running down the freeway? And is that an added fuel cost then? Or are these trucks already running? They're just going to have a different makeup with this organic, wonderful organic waste?
Well, it's pretty much the same. There could be, we're trying to, you know, if the compost thing comes, and even in Engle and Gray, because we're adding food waste, we're going to be trying to, we're going to be transloading our green and food waste at the landfill to try to minimize the trips down 101. And then if we build the compost plant, it's on our property, so that'll be one less trip a day. When they return home at the end of the day, they're going to put it there and then park. So we're hoping that'll lower it. And if we build this plant, excuse me, the big thing that we're trying to do is we're going to produce CNG fuel. They will produce CNG fuel out of there. So we're trying to get in a long-term agreement for fuel. So we're turning garbage into CNG fuel. So that's going to be a big savings.
Okay, very good. I appreciate the explanation. Thank you. That's all I have.
Yeah, there are public comments on the item. Please.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening. Hear me out, Council. Obviously, I hope you read the letter regarding the vacant fee. And this came about when I explained in the letters when my mother passed away that I did clean up the house and use the service and then cancel the service because I am going to be remodeling the house on the inside. It's going to take quite a bit of time. I'm doing it myself on spare time. So I ran into this problem, which I explained in the letter, and I don't see any purpose. If the company is not doing anything for you, what gain do I have by paying for a fee that they don't do anything? So that's how I look at it, because if you go down to the store, you buy something, you gain something. But if you don't have any service, why do you have to pay for it? And I don't know how this all arrived. I heard about something about it was on the water fee or something back on times before. But my thrust is to eliminate it. They don't need it. There's no need to have a vacant fee because the trucks are going by picking up garbage in the neighborhood. They pass a house that's vacant. Someday that the house will be full. Another house may be vacant. So the overall case would be they're going to gain money by the garbage fees and in general. So I'd like to see the whole thing be taken out of the next contract, the vacant fee. I don't see any purpose in it whatsoever. I like my money back all the way back to August 1st. I haven't paid them because I don't feel it was right to begin with. Normally, when you buy something or order something, you get results. You don't get results by having an empty house and having to have to pay a fee because the house is empty. So I would like to see the council direct the city manager negotiate it out. It'd be a good negotiating tool to let them have their new increase in fees, take out the vacant rate. There's a house over there that's been 5 years old, like I explained in the letter. If they're paying a vacant fee for five solid years, why? The houses that burned down on Farrell Road, I understand, are still paying the vacant fee. And again, their house probably won't be done for a couple of years. So why do they have to pay it? I don't see any reason for it. Please take it out. Question?
Thank you for your comment. Can we recap the...
I was just looking up on the vacancy rate. The rates are based on the customer count, and that's what happened long before I got over here. So the council established a vacancy rate to have the non-participators pay the fixed cost of service. Rates are based on the customer count. Less customers means higher rates for everybody else. So that was the justification back whenever this was decided by the council. So I just thought I'd throw that in there.
And that's basically the summary of the what we've already said is the justification for the for that portion of the rate. Is there any other comment on the item?
Two things real quick. On the fuel, I know that cities and a lot of companies who use fuel will buy long-term fuel. They'll go in and say, can I get 10,000 gallons at this price? So it's a fixed price for many gallons of fuel that they'll use over the next year, and I'm wondering if the this company does that, and it's just curiosity on my part. Also, there was an amendment that happened to 10A today, and I've seen it happen with other things. I'm one of the ones who reads these reports, and so it would be nice if when the agenda comes out, we could have all the information, because I didn't get a chance to read it. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
My wife just reminded me that those calculations that they talked about, the vacant fee, several years ago. Remember, the town was much smaller. There were a lot less customers, a lot smaller base for the garbage company to work against for the, making that fee, as opposed to it is today. There's a lot more people here, a lot more reasons to take it out.
Thank you again. Would anyone else like to comment on the item?
I have just one real quick question, and that is, I have a lot of plant material on my lot, and there was a time when I asked for more than one green waste container, and I was told that there was a one per household limit for green waste, and I'm just wondering if that can change, has changed, and it's possible to get more than one green waste container so I don't have to borrow one from everybody in the neighborhood on Green Waste Day. Thank you.
Yes, people can have more than one can. You just have to ask for it. There could have been a shortage at that time. And on the question on fuel, we've considered many times to do a hedge, and that's when you set the price for fuel, but it was going all over the place. And at that point in time, a lot of people were considering it, it would have been a disaster. It's moved that much. But if we do this compo gas thing, we'll have an agreement with compo gas the day of that agreement that's going to last the pretty much the term of the agreement, so that whatever that is that day, and that's when we'll hedge it, and that would make the most sense because it's coming right from our own trash. Okay.
Any other comment on the item?
Heather Jensen, and yes, I would just like to commend the South County Sanitary. I think they provide an excellent service. Their drivers are so friendly and so cooperative, and I think that's good job. Good job. Well done. I would just like clarification on the tipping fees, and I know the cost of is all going up, but just clarification that Coal Canyon Landfill is actually the same ownership company as South County Sanitary. I just think that's an interesting insight as far as they're raising the tipping fees, and it just kind of is the whole snowball effect. Is that kind of it? Okay. And then also on the green waste, and yes, we have three containers, so you can get them. And is on the green waste, is that actually what's going into this new organic aerobic thingy that you're talking about? So where is the green waste going now? It's being shipped out. Okay, and then processed, or?
Now we're going to keep it here.
And, okay. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you for that comment.
One thing, too, it's been discussed. This came up a couple of years ago when I first got here. Our company does own the landfill. That's true. But we also have the lowest landfill prices in the county, but it's not even close. So that's one of the reasons we get to keep our rates as low as they are, because you know we subsidize it. So actually it's beneficial. If you look at the other landfills, you could direct us to go to another landfill. That's up to you. But take a look at the rates. It's not even close. Okay.
Mike Dreese, living in Rio Grande. And a question I have on the green waste, when you change it, I think today you could throw any kind of wood you want into the green containers. Is that correct?
like a board that's not treated, but an old 2x4, right? Can you, on the, with the new method, are we going to be able to do that? So 2x4s or 4x4s, as long as it's not treated, it'll be okay.
It might be helpful to get all the public comments first and then respond. It's getting difficult for the record.
Okay, so is there any other comment on it? And we'll, if you have questions, we'll respond to those at the end. Any other comments on the waste item? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public comment. And is there a response to the... That was it. No more questions. Any more questions from council?
Because I remember this deal on the vacant fee being actually a little bit different originally. It was originally, as I remember, not that I was here 20 years ago, but I've seen this come up at other communities. It's really kind of an enforcement mechanism for when you're first starting out to go to publicly collected trash from when nobody, where everybody dealt with their trash on their own, and that it was oriented toward the idea that you were going to pay something whether you use the service or not. As this is, I'm sort of looking whether I'm just remembering this totally wrong, that whether you're going to use the service or not, that you were going to pay something into it, that there was going to be this group service that had a huge capital investment cost, and those people who might just choose to burn their trash in the backyard, it wasn't all that long ago that people did that. As I remember, that's really what the vacant fee is about. It may not be necessary today, but that at least was my intention. Rather than the real capital costs, there are so few vacant. And you also, and I will say that the mechanics of moving people in and out of the vacant could get difficult as well, and would beg people not to start up their trash, particularly today when you have very small amounts. So I ask that as a kind of a question and comment at the same time to see if I'm the only one that's remembering it that way, and throw that out to staff.
You're older than I am, I guess.
I've been a wonk for a long time.
I'll just chime in. I wasn't here, so I can't help with the recollection of the original discussion. It is solid waste, so there is also a public health and safety component. It's not the kind of thing that you want to allow, compiling up and not getting picked up. So it is very important that we have everything in place and that people do dispose of their trash. So there is a public health component also that plays in.
Just to weigh in on that, if you don't charge a base rate, a vacant rate, then you would perhaps incentivize people to not have the service and to take their trash themselves to the county landfill or something. And because we are in an incorporated city and we have a system, we want people to pay into the system so that the costs are reasonable for everyone.
What percentage of the regular fee is the vacant fee? Is that...
It would depend on the size of the container, but for comparison, it's about $11 for the vacant fee and about $17 a month for your smallest trash container.
Okay, thank you for that.
Do we have any idea how many vacant fees there are? I mean, my impression is there's one or two, but are there...
That I don't know.
Well, no?
We didn't ask that question.
I know you know
two,
but
so.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so we've closed public comment. Coming back to the council for comment thoughts. I'll start with Councilmember Guthrie.
I guess I will deal with the vacant fee. I do think it's appropriate to leave it in place. It is something perhaps to look at for the future because I'm not really sure that it's necessary anymore. But without knowing, without really doing a whole other study of one, how many people are affected by it, and two, is it realistic that we really do need this, because I do believe it's more of an enforcement than it really is a capital, than it's like a meter fee for water. So it's something we might look at in the future, but I wouldn't be particularly interested in looking at it tonight. We are not approving the future organics plant tonight, and I will be surprised if it's not more expensive, but we'll deal with that when we get to it. So I just want to be clear that I'm not voicing an opinion either way on that. We have actually, I believe, been doing this organics program for a while, so this is not brand new. So that piece of it is not really a new piece. It's just an extension of what we've been doing for a while. As for the fact that fuel is down and the overall cost here is up, I do trust the study that was done that was presented back in October. So I think it was October that looked really, really deeply into those numbers. We didn't hear that long discussion tonight, fortunately. But I was confident then that those numbers were accurate, and I'm confident tonight. So I am. I would like staff to at some point read for the public. It is one, I think, small change to the table. There was one corrected table that is in the change, so that's clear to the public what was changed tonight for our purposes. Perhaps we can get that read into the record so it's perfectly clear what we're approving. But with that change, I'm prepared to move forward.
Sure. We did have a supplemental memo that came out to the council. Thanks to one of our eagle-eyed council members, we discovered that there was a problem with Exhibit A to the resolution. The charge for the 96-gallon green waste service was correctly, the current fee was correctly reflected at $3.19. The proposed fee was correctly reflected at $3.29. That is a 3.25% increase. For some reason, we had a crazy number in there, like 724 or something. So I'm not sure how that got in there, but we did make that correction. That is the correction that caused the supplemental to change. It was based on the proposed rate adjustment percentage being incorrect, but the math is correct as far as the current rate and what the proposed rate would be. That actually occurred in two instances on both the residential and on the commercial. Same 96-gallon green waste service, but on both residential and the 218. Both the residential and the commercial. The 218 notice was correct. There was no problem with the 218 notice. That did correctly identify all three of those columns, but on our exhibit to the resolution, somehow we got a little typo in there, so we fixed that.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Brown.
Yeah, I'm ready to move forward. This has been studied at length, and I think it's studied at length to the point of justification. I had some concerns early on. I do have concerns about the Compo Gas project. I'm not saying I'm against it. I just have some concerns about taking on a lengthy contract, and we just need to have public discussion about that in a public forum so that the public's aware of what the ramifications of that could be. But other than that, for what's before us tonight, I have no problem going forward.
Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you. I'm ready to move forward as well. As Councilmember Guthrie stated, we did have an in-depth report from the consultant that we worked on in October, where they dove very deeply into all the increases and all kinds of different fees from Cold Canyon, et cetera. I think the rate increases are reasonable, the 3.25%. As Debbie had stated, the tipping fees are going up, cost of doing business is going up, and the one-third of the increase is based on the implementing the organics program, which I think is a good thing. So I'm ready to move forward on that. Just a note on the vacant fee. I do think that we need to have a vacant rate. I think that even when a house is vacant, if it's for sale by a realtor, for sale by owner, you have mail that comes to the house, you pull some weeds. If we didn't have the trash cans there, you might end up with people taking trash and leaving it or dumping it. So I think it's a small fee for the assurance of the citizens that the refuse is going to be taken away. So I'm okay with that. And those are all my comments. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think it makes sense to move forward with the three-year proposal based on the analysis and also the opportunity to avoid the interim reviews. And in general, I'm not one to support rate increases, but we are also bound by a franchise agreement, which also helps control and justify and garner reasonable increases that are reflective of increased costs for doing business, basically. Also, in comparison to other agencies, the Rio Grande is still maintaining one of the lowest rates in the area. So I think that's good for us and our ratepayers. I also really wanted to emphasize that a third of this rate increase is caused by Assembly Bill 1826, which is mandating a commercial organics diversion program, an unfunded mandate that requires local jurisdictions to develop a recycling program to divert organic waste, such as food waste, from landfills to an authorized composting facility. It's another bill passed without any consideration for the cost of businesses and our ratepayers. Worse, the organic waste will need to be transported via tractor trailer, contradicting the state's mandates for reduced greenhouse gas emissions and without consideration on our impacts to our roadways. So I really wanted to emphasize that because here is a business that is being reasonable in their approach and trying to keep our rates low, and they've done a very good job of that, but yet they're hit with another unfunded mandate that they must and they shall move forward with, yet given very little probably guidance from the state, but very little funding to do so. And it's important that I think we all recognize, just like everybody else's businesses, that you know, they're struggling out there. And I think based on what they had to do, it's reasonable for us to move forward. And maybe we can lobby the state a little bit harder related to recognizing cost to our businesses. So with all of those factors, I'm ready to support and move forward with the resolution and the rate increases as recommended.
I'm also willing to move forward at this point. I would comment in terms of the vacant fee. I agree with Councilmember Barnich's comment on the need for the vacant fee, in that often there is some trash that's generated on a property, even when it's vacant. But I would note that in cases where we've had fires and major structural damage, that we often have roll-offs and some other large collection mechanism, and I would hope that we're not charging a vacant fee simultaneously when we have a roll-off or something of that nature in terms of major renovation of the structure. So with that said, I'm also willing to move forward with this tonight.
Mr. Mayor, I would move a resolution of the City Council of Arroyo Grande establishing integrated solid waste collection service rates for January 1st, 2016, 17, and 18, as presented on the dais.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded, and I find that we have received 5 protests. Is that correct? And that,
yes.
That is certainly not a 50%.
That's correct, Mayor. So the majority protest has not been reached. I may have misheard it, but I think the motion, I don't recall hearing it. It sets the rates for April 1st, January 16th, January 1st, 2017, and January 1st, 2018. I'd like to see if the motion reflects that.
It does, but maybe I misread it. You want me to do it again? I'd move a resolution of the City of Arroyo Grande establishing integrated solid waste collection service rates for April 1st, 2016, January 1, 2017, and January 1, 2018.
My second stands.
Okay, may we have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnage?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes.
Yeah, I was looking at this one. It was on the dais, but...
Yeah, this is in consideration that the next item is probably going to be long. Let's take a 10-minute recess. Okay, if we could please come back to order. Moving on with public hearings, item 10B. I'll ask the city clerk to please introduce the item.
Item 10B is consideration of housing element update for the 2014-2019 Regional Housing Needs Assessment Cycle, General Plan Amendment Number 14-002, and the negative declaration, and two, the ordinance amending portions of Title 16 of the Rio Grande Municipal Code regarding emergency shelters and supportive and transitional housing, Development Code Amendment 14-006, citywide.
Thank you, and may we have the staff report, please. Director McFlish.
Mayor Hill and members of the council, it's been a long and winding road to bring you the most recent update to the housing element and a component to implement that element. So to give you the staff report is Kelly Heffernan, Associate Planner.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. The purpose of tonight's hearing is to review and receive public comment on the draft housing element update and draft ordinance regarding emergency shelters. Council adopted the city's previous housing element in 2013, which was later certified by the state. As a brief overview, the housing element is one of seven required elements of the general plan that provides a strategy for meeting housing needs of various income levels within the city. The State Department of Housing and Community Development, or HCD, is responsible for reviewing and then hopefully certifying the housing element. More specifically, the purpose of the housing element is to increase the supply of housing that is equitable for families of all income categories, with an emphasis on infill development. On a regional level, the purpose of the housing element is to provide greater opportunities for residents to live closer to where they work. The housing element contains information about the needs assessment, which means the city's fair share of regional housing need as determined by HCD and the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. It includes an analysis of the city's resources to aid housing development, which includes land availability, infrastructure, and financial resources, an analysis of constraints to housing development, including those imposed by the city in the form of regulations, and then also, of course, environmental constraints, a review of how well the city implemented the previous housing element update, and then finally, the policy program, which is the core of the document that explains how we intend to meet our goals of providing sufficient housing according to our needs assessment. So this slide shows Arroyo Grande's fair share of the anticipated future housing demand. These numbers initially come from HCD, and then the county, this is for the county as a whole, and then they're further refined by SLOCOG, based on a formula that considers population, income, employment, and vacancy factors. Each city is required to update their housing element to accommodate adequate general plan and zoning capacity for their respective allocation by income category. Note that these units are not required to be built, but rather the housing element must show that the city can accommodate the additional housing units through its policies, programs, and the land inventory. As a comparison, the city was required to accommodate a total of 362 units for our previous cycle. The distribution of 242 total units for this cycle represents a 33% reduction from last time, just so you know. The goals, policies, and programs basically create the action plan of the housing element. Most of the goals, policies, and programs from the previous cycle have been retained since they're still relevant. Several policies and programs have either been added or revised for clarity purposes, as shown on this and the next few slides. So these include
establishing a program to provide assistance to first-time home buyers, monitoring the loss of permanent workforce housing from vacation rentals, amending the zoning ordinance to encourage farm worker housing, and amending the development code to define transitional and supportive housing as allowable residential uses. Program G1-3 was amended from the previous update in response, actually, to council comments. This program previously stated that the city shall amend the development code to allow development of five or more multiple family attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit. The intent of this program is to remove obstacles to the development of multifamily housing. Council was concerned about not having any oversight at all over the design of larger multifamily projects. Staff therefore modified this program to state that the city shall amend the development code to allow development of up to 15 multiple family attached units in the MF and MFA zoning districts with a minor use permit, subject to design review through the Architectural Review Committee. Development of over 15 multiple family attached units in those zoning districts requires a conditional use permit. So this modification was actually a negotiation with HCD, with staff. After resubmitting the draft housing element to HCD last year, the agency responded with additional city actions that must occur prior to document certification. And these include implementing program K2-1 regarding emergency shelters, implementing program K2-2 regarding transitional and supportive housing, and then including a program that increases the allowable density in the office mixed-use zoning district from 15 to 20 dwelling units per acre for standalone multifamily housing projects with a minor use permit. This addresses the issue of reducing government constraints that they feel is very important. And then ensure that there is adequate opportunity for public participation throughout this process. The housing element has been amended to include this information, and the proposed draft ordinance implements programs K2-1 and K2-2. To provide more opportunities for public participation, the Planning Commission held a public workshop and two public hearings on the housing element update. The notice list for the most recent public hearings has been greatly expanded to include many more individuals and agencies, anybody who we thought that could possibly be interested in it. We're doing the best that we can. Regarding the proposed ordinance for emergency shelters, staff proposes to add definitions, amend the use tables, and then include development standards. So, starting with definitions, and these are all from state government code, emergency shelters are defined as housing with minimal supportive services for homeless persons that is limited to occupancy of 6 months or less by a homeless person. No individual or household may be denied emergency shelter because of an inability to pay. Supportive housing means housing with no limit on the length of stay that is occupied by the target population and that is linked to on-site or off-site service that assists the supportive housing resident in retaining the housing, improving his or her health status, and maximizing his or her ability to live and, when possible, work in the community. Supportive housing shall be considered a residential use of property and shall be subject only to those restrictions that apply to other residential dwellings in that particular zoning district. So the target population means persons with low incomes who have one or more disabilities, including mental illness, HIV or AIDS, substance abuse, or a chronic health condition, and may include adults, emancipated minors, families with children, elderly persons, young adults aging out of the foster care system, individuals exiting from institutional settings, veterans, and homeless individuals.
And finally, transitional housing means a building or a group of buildings configured as rental housing but operated under a program that requires the termination of assistance and recirculation of the assisted unit to another eligible person at a future point in time that is no less than 6 months from the beginning of the assistance. Transitional housing shall be considered a residential use of property and does not include state licensed residential care facilities. As discussed in the staff report, it is proposed that emergency shelters be allowed in the industrial mixed use and the highway mixed use zoning districts with a minor use permit. It is also proposed that transitional and supportive housing be permitted in all residential districts consistent with state law. State law also allows cities to impose development standards in local regulations for emergency shelters. Staff proposes that standards relating to the following issues be included. And so we have number of persons required on-site parking. So I'm not going to read all this because it's too much, but I'll try to speak slowly so you can just look at it. But so it's the first one is about the number of people that are allowed or number of beds, and then the next one is about what kind of parking you need to provide on-site. And there's standards for exterior lighting, and then also, of course, security. And requirements for on-site management. And we can also include standards on the waiting and the intake areas. Laundry facilities and refuse enclosures, and then also there the common facilities and outdoor activities. There's regulations regarding when you can have anything going on outside because of noise concerns for the surrounding neighborhood, and then finally the actual facility location. So we're proposing that the shelter not be located within 300 feet of another shelter or any kind of a school or any kind of a park. So this slide shows how the 300-foot radius from the Ocean View School property line impacts properties within the IMU zoning district. Over 9 acres are within the radius area. However, most of the properties immediately adjacent to El Camino Real are eligible locations for emergency shelters. There are no properties impacted by the proposed location criteria with the HMU zoning district. And then just so you know, there are transit stops that are well situated on El Camino Real and also on East Grand Avenue for transportation to services. So in summary, the housing element update provides the conditions for producing and preserving an adequate supply of diverse types of housing, including special needs housing. It offers strategies that address the city's local housing needs, including an inventory of land adequately zoned for housing in all income categories, and a commitment to assist in housing development through regulatory concessions and incentives. State law requires jurisdictions to make a diligent effort to involve all economic segments of the community in the housing element update process. The public hearing process provides an opportunity for the public to identify problems and propose solutions to housing issues facing the city today. By submitting the housing element to HCD, the city will be in compliance with the statutory procedure for adoption of an updated housing element. A certified housing element also makes the city eligible for state and federal funding for various types of housing programs. As a potential disadvantage, some of the policies identified
in the document encourage increased densities for infill sites and therefore could result in parking or other neighborhood issues related to future proposed projects. However, development of housing at maximum densities is not required, and all projects are subject to CEQA. So in conclusion, the Planning Commission recommends that Council adopt a resolution approving the housing element update and introduce an ordinance amending the development code to allow emergency shelters as a permitted use in the industrial mixed-use and highway mixed-use zoning districts. And just so you know, once the ordinance is adopted, the city will send the document to the state, and we're going to keep our fingers crossed that it gets certified. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for staff. Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you. Let's see, Kelly. I had talked to you a little bit about, and Teresa, about the parking requirements for the accessory dwelling units, which is a granny unit, but maybe granny units, we think of they're detached, but actually inside the house they can be, the ADUs can be as well. What do we have right now on the books? And I realize that's not the housing element, but it's the code afterwards for the parking requirements for a granny unit.
It's just one space uncovered parking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then on page 6 of the staff report, yes. Let me get to that. I think you actually had a slide on it too. It's A.15, the city shall pursue program assistance for first-time home buyers. What was the thought behind that as far as how would the city possibly do that?
Well, I know the county used to provide this program, and because of the decrease in federal funding, they've put their efforts and their money towards other types of programs. But it was... So there's lessons learned from the county. You know, it would have to be something that was obviously set up as a program and funding prioritized for it. So we'd have to look into how we would do that. Without the RDA, you know, we're a little bit strapped, but we do have our affordable housing in lieu fee, you know, that fund.
Okay. And then... I'm going to talk about, later I'll talk about the attainable housing part of the element, but in kind of leading up to that, what do you think as far as the multifamily, because we're seeing some lots in the village that are being developed, and some of them are zoned multifamily, but they're going more towards single family or PUDs because that's where the most of the probably development money is for them to make. What do you think are the obstacles to actually getting the multifamily housing? And is there something in the housing element that we could change or tweak so that we can get some multifamily housing?
Well, I would say that trying to get multifamily housing is difficult. I mean, we haven't had any apartments built except for Pike Place in a lot of years. And Pike Place apartments are pretty much the anomaly. Most apartments are built by nonprofit organizations, and it's a very strategic financial bundle of solutions. So they go for tax credits. They go to the Housing Trust Fund. They go to, you know, it's very complicated to try to put these together because they're trying to make them on purpose to be affordable. Mm-hmm. So if you had it for market rate apartments, there's just not as much to be made out of that kind of a product than for something that you can obviously sell and then walk away from. So it takes the will of the developers and education of the developers that this is something that is greatly needed.
Is there incentives that we could offer that we're not offering right now for developers to make it more attractive to them to do multifamily housing?
That's part of what's in the housing element, is to provide incentives for that type of product, yes.
Okay.
So we have a discussion in the housing element. You referred to it. It's referring to what we're terming attainable housing. Some jurisdictions refer to a workforce housing product. This is our version of that. It can include rental housing and a series of a list of other types, including those units with universal design, accessible units. So this is a document where we're kind of setting forward that policy, and then the implementation of that will likely come in the form of a development code amendment to provide specific incentives for rental housing and for restricted affordable rental housing. Those incentives are built in to cities' processing requirements in the relief from impact fees. So we do have that incentive for affordable units. We don't have that incentive as of yet for market rate rental housing.
Oh, okay. So because that's important too, but I'm not talking about subsidizing in any way. I'm just talking about something small that people can afford that we don't see built right now. We don't currently. It's in the housing element, but we don't necessarily. We haven't spelled out any incentives, but we can look at that going forward.
Yes, and the housing element includes a list of a few incentives: relaxation of development standards, flexibility in parking requirements. These are hard issues to solve, and it makes everybody kind of shift in their seats. But these are the kinds of things that make such projects more expensive to build and less desirable to build, rental units.
Okay. Okay, I think those are my only questions for right now. Thank you. Thank you, Kelly and Teresa.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I understand that this is a plan that we need to have to meet the requirements of the state law. So we're really not deciding any kind of policy. It's really just approving the plan so you can move forward. Correct? Okay. So this is regarding page 4 of the staff report. Related to that, it has to do with the 15 units. I'm kind of concerned that the state is coming in and mandating us to change the amount of units that we feel is appropriate for our community and what's appropriate for our city dynamics, and also certainly what we hear from the public regarding higher density projects that maybe might fit another community better than ours. So can you kind of explain how that discussion occurred with the Housing and Community Development Program related? I think there was some give and take about wanting us to increase this density in a different district, and then the back and forth that you went to kind of get up with a better compromise. Can you just explain that a little bit to ease my concerns about those two wonderful words, higher density?
Yeah, the state is trying really hard to get jurisdictions to lift the constraints, the governmental constraints, of trying to get higher densities. We really need more housing in this state, and it's as you know, we're building the typical single family detached. So they want to get higher densities, and we talked with the state about they wanted to create a 20 dwelling unit per acre density in all of the mixed-use zoning districts that currently have just 15 dwelling units per acre for 100% multifamily type of a project versus a mixed-use project. So they wanted to have it in the GMU, the FOMU, the Fair Oaks mixed-use district, and the office mixed-use district. But because both the GMU and the FOMU are right along our commercial core along Grand Avenue. We thought that that really wasn't an appropriate place, and so we talked them out of that, but they wouldn't let go of it, so they wanted us to stick it into the OMU. So right now, though, I mean, if somebody wanted to build a 100% multifamily project in OMU, they can do it with a 15 dwelling unit per acre density. So they can do that today. But they don't. If we approve this, if the council approves this, you don't have to build it at that right. maximum density. You know, it's
allowable.
It's allowable, yeah. But there's obstacles. So the state sees that to get these densities, parking becomes a problem, becomes an obstacle. So that's why they've kind of targeted parking as one of the key issues that we need to grapple with to try to ease up on the parking to allow those densities, higher densities to occur. That's what they would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then drifting over to page 8, it's section A10-3. And I think you might have touched on this. Does this mean that the office mixed-use district could now be used for 100% high density for a multifamily housing project?
Yes. And okay. it could already do that at 15 dwelling units.
Okay. So basically then the difference is that 20 could now be mm-hmm. used instead of the 15. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Mm-hmm. And then page 15, section A31, what is meant by providing greater flexibility in development standards? Could you just give us a few examples related to what that broad, and I know it will be developed more specifically, but what's the intent there related to the flexibility in the development standards?
Well, it would be similar to what you would see with the planning and development. You know, we allow flexibility like in our setbacks, our floor area ratio, our lot coverage, our height restrictions, and then, of course, parking. Parking's always in there, too.
Okay. Well, that's not okay, but I appreciate the giving a little bit better idea about what exactly that meant by that flexibility. And now that brings me to page 23, and it's section D1, and I'd really like defined relaxed parking standards for apartments containing extremely low and or senior housing. I guess my concerns here is that how would negative impacts to surrounding areas be mitigated if parking standards are relaxed or there is reduced parking restrictions? It is a hot button and item, and I think a very valid one. And so when I read this, again, even though it's a plan, and I know there'll be final approval processes and things develop further, but I do have some concerns about that. And so maybe you could elaborate on what the thoughts are there from the state and what we've come up with.
I think Kelly certainly touched on the state recognizes barriers to providing density in your community, and barriers can mean really strict development standards, and one of those standards is parking. Reduced parking standards or flexibility in parking standards may not have to mean for us a reduction in the number of parking units. I think we can look at this through a variety of ways. The Planning Commission is very interested in opening up the city's parking standards and we're working on that now. So that may very well include looking at things like the provision of requiring garage parking covered and covered fully enclosed parking. And the reason for this, of course, is folks don't often use their garages for storage of cars, but for storage of other things, and that has a ripple effect on parking. So perhaps one of the things we can look at is uncovered parking or a parking carport parking for certain housing developments. There may be opportunities. It was raised recently by an individual, Mr. Peachy, that says, well, some of the parking stall standards or the parking lot standards are pretty restrictive in terms of spacing of stalls and spacing between stalls. In certain areas, maybe in infill areas or commercial areas, that sort of thing can be looked at too. And, you know, these all can account for squeezing in more parking or providing parking that works for types of developments. So those are some of the things we're looking at that may indeed be able to implement these policies more than just requiring a reduction in the number of parking stalls.
Okay, I really appreciate the expansion on that, the one statement, and also appreciate how thoughtful the team has been related to, you know, developing what the state is offering and then trying to morph that into how it best fits us. And then I believe I just have two more questions. This one is on page 36, referencing section L1 and the persons with disabilities. And are incentives being considered or available, like those that have been described in the low-income housing section, through the design process? I know L2 indicates that the city will ensure units accommodate handicap or disabled access, but I don't really see specific incentives to do so. And would added incentives that were specific to that help address the need for this specialized housing that Mr. Haggerty spoke of earlier?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, an important issue. We don't have anything in the element that speaks specifically for incentives for handicapped persons, but I'm thinking about this. Most people with disabilities are low income, and, you know, all of our low income housing that we have would be provided incentives. So kind of through that way is how we might be able to do that, or we could do something specific for these individuals as well. But at least we have something already. But so
maybe
the development impact fees would be one of the things that would be, you know, reduced or waived.
Maybe adding more units. Maybe adding more units, specified for the disabled, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a combination of in lieu fees to offset if they're on Social Security or disability income. Maybe a match in that regard. Thank you for that. And then lastly, this has to do with what's described on page 67 as barrier-free design concept for multifamily housing. Will these design requirements add costs to housing price or cost of rent? And if so, then wouldn't that be adding a constraint of affordability?
Well, it could.
The answer is yes. It does.
Okay.
It does tend to add costs. The more more restrictions you add to the housing types, tend to increase your cost to build house to build the units, so per unit cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to build in and design barrier-free housing for new developments, and then the cost in relationship to the whole project cost probably is not that different, and certainly easier than going back to retrofit existing housing. And we've encountered challenges with, for example, our People's Self-Help Housing Project, where we're trying to address the design for different unit types within the same housing development, and had to certainly spend extra time trying to figure out the creative ways to make sure that works. And staff is certainly happy to do that. In terms of the housing element, the policy does identify that as something to continue to make more flexible, make easier for folks to come in that want to build this housing, provide any incentives or any flexibility to allow them to do that. But there may indeed be increased costs with increased standards.
Okay. Thank you very much for all of the clarifications. It really is helpful in understanding exactly
you know, what we're faced with, acknowledging that we already know pretty much what our lacks are, and then trying to balance the state requirements on top. So thank you for that. I'm finished with my questions. Thank you.
Councilmember Guthrie.
I just have a couple of real mechanical. This has to do, I think this came up when we talked about this last time, it has to do with this MUP for apartments. And granted, CEQA was almost always going to be invoked in some way. But we do have this appeal process through the Planning Commission. And I'm wondering, is the state aware of that, and are we okay with that process? Because I would be very surprised if any apartment unit of that size didn't get appealed.
Well, it sure sounded like, you know, in talking with the HCD staff, that they were familiar with our development code. Okay. So I would assume that they would understand that, yes.
Okay. And then the second, this is a real mechanical question. So this is going to be good, and it's supposed to be from 14 to 19. Mm-hmm. We're now in 16. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be 2 years, and we're going to be starting over again. Is there any way to kind of front load this, that we can next time not have to go through, we put it all together and submit it to them in the back and forth? Is there some sort of template we can use? I mean, it just feels like, you know, you send it to them and it's kind of like an inspection program where they have to find something to send back to us. I'm just wondering if there isn't a state template that we mm-hmm. can. That we could short-circuit this with?
Well, we're already on the short cycle. A lot of other jurisdictions have a 7-year, and we have 5-year, and it has to do with the county and SLOCOG and our sustainability plan, and, you know. And I believe that I haven't looked into this for a while, but I know that there is some kind of an easier reporting thing, and if you did it that way, I think you got some kind of relief in the amount of time that you had. But regardless, because of what the county has on board with the sustainability plan, that we really don't have any choice. So we don't really, I don't know.
I think our neighboring jurisdictions, we're all very interested in getting on the 7-year cycle. We'll be continuing to explore that. They have come out with programs for streamlining. If you have to meet a lot of criteria, we'll continue to look at that. If there's not a lot of changes in the next 2 years from HCD, this could go a lot more quickly. Are able to bring to you some of the implementation measures. We're starting with one this evening with an ordinance. Then we'll be modifying our housing element, which will make it easier for them to agree and certify for us. So that's all we could do is seek the longer, the 7-year cycle, work with our neighboring jurisdictions to do that, and try to do what we can to meet any streamlining criteria that they come out with.
And then the last question has to do with, we've been relatively successful with developing affordable housing in this community. I just don't see that reflected here, and, you know, maybe there's a table I missed about what we have achieved. I think relative to certainly in the Five Cities area, we're probably the lead provider of affordable housing, and yet it just seems like, oh, you know, okay, now it's another 260 units, you know. So I'm wondering, since it's not mentioned here, it makes me think that we don't get any credit for it.
It is in there, and it is reflected.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for that.
Councilmember Brown?
I just have a few questions. My mic's on. Just a few questions, because a lot of questions have already been asked. When was the last housing element actually certified?
It was in 2014.
It was certified in 2014. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then, excuse me, that kind of fix that you did about the level of review for 15 units that we talked about earlier, I apologize for asking this. I should know this, but it, generally speaking, SEEK was going to be triggered during that process. Is that not correct?
Not. There's infill exemptions that are that jurisdictions use quite a bit nowadays.
That are considered exempt?
Yeah, unless if there's definitely an environmental impact that needs to be addressed, then, you know, you would do an initial study.
Well, and that goes to the second part of my question. Teresa, I seem to remember some projects that didn't have to go through Planning Commission or City Council review, and you said at some point, well, that's true, but I don't want to be the one to necessarily, you know, make the decision. There might be some reason to put this through review. So I'm assuming going forward, that's kind of the process, that if you notice something that needs extra review, we're going to do it anyway, right?
Yes, certainly the requirement from the state and that we're adopting, if you so choose this evening, wouldn't preempt any requirements for us to conduct CEQA review. We still have the same findings to make,
right,
for these developments, and those include, you know, logistical growth patterns, neighborhood compatibility issues. So we still have to make those.
Right.
It does require a process that's more administrative for,
right,
those zones that are intended for,
right,
you know, these higher and in increased density housing types, and up to 15 units. Perhaps,
right,
you know, they can be approved administratively, but it doesn't preempt any of our processes, including
our appeal
process.
I just think about those rare cases where something might come up where, you know, it might be a community hot button issue or something, you know, maybe it's traffic, maybe it's parking, you know, who knows. But
And if they're not meeting a certain standard, then that certainly may trigger a process where it would have to go,
okay,
up to a higher review.
Great. Thank you for that. Mr. Mayor, those are my questions.
Having heard the comment on studio and single room apartments, we're, I would presume, promoting those kinds of ideas in this plan. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that it's certainly embedded in the attainable housing provision section of the housing element.
And then in terms of parking, are we doing any kind of incentives or anything in terms of encouraging underground parking or construction on, you know, over the parking facility? To
Generally, I mean, underground parking is great for efficient land use, and if that works out well for a project's design, we might see something like that. Generally, it's going to be much more expensive, so it's not considered an incentive. So we don't have anything explicit on that, but again, willing to look at design considerations as well as, you know, parking configuration and parking standard numbers when we come back forward with our amended parking requirements.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, those conclude the questions. Are there public comments on this item?
I didn't get the gentleman's name who spoke during the accommodation periods, but he brought up some really interesting things, so I just want to bring them up. And one of that is the new movement nowadays to have tiny houses. And, you know, the thing I think of is, do we have a spot where we've even thought about doing tiny house parks, kind of like RV parks? And he mentioned garages being converted over to housing. And he also mentioned if you have a large home, basically making it into a duplex-like thing. And so at some point, I'd like to hear more about how that would work. Because I know garages and stuff, you guys already have something on the books about converting garages over to livable space. But the whole tiny house movement, I'd like to see what the city thinks on that. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll answer questions at the end. Is there any other comment on the item?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and council people. My name is Jack Hardy. I'm president of Century 21 Hometown Realty here in Arroyo Grande. And this is of great interest to me. This is what I do for a living. And I have to tell you, in California, we actually have a housing crisis taking place as we speak. And it's a lot more than infill for affordable housing or low-income housing, which I'm not saying it's not important. That is important. I don't think most people realize the extent of what's happening in California. Today, we need just to keep up in California with natural growth. I'm talking about people like me that got married and have kids, and those kids grow up and have kids. We need 220,000 new homes a year in California. For the last 2 years, the city of Houston, Texas, has built more homes than the state of California. Does anybody really realize that? The city of Houston, Texas, is building more homes than the state of California. The state's not doing their job. The counties are not doing their job. The cities are not doing their job. And we have a far bigger crisis. What's happening? We have an inventory problem taking place statewide. It's driving prices up. It's making it less affordable, not more affordable, less affordable. I see Arroyo Grande Water Conservation. It's a very good policy. 2001, I was involved in the Berry Gardens project. Everybody here knows where that project is. When we put that project in, it cut the water usage when we converted that from strawberries to homes almost 85%. We can conserve water by putting homes in. So we really need to think seriously about what we're going to do. We have a lot of infill opportunities in Arroyo Grande. We have some other opportunities. We need to look at some other tracks. I mean, where are the tracks of homes for people that, you know, I know some of you up there have children. It's not going to be long ago. Those children are going to grow up and start families of their own. They're going to need to live someplace. And while it's admirable to try to find emergency shelters, and I think that's an honorable thing, we need housing just for, I haven't heard us talk about tonight, regular, everyday, three-bedroom, two-bath homes for families. And that's an important issue. And I think, I hope the council will take this under consideration. The reality is that we've now, in California, but specifically right here in San Luis Obispo County, the jobs for electricians, plumbers, concrete workers, carpenters, those jobs are leaving. They're almost non-existent anymore. So I would ask you to consider looking at the entire housing element, and more so than just for, and again, I'm not knocking the homeless situation or the emergency shelter. I think that's admirable. But let's look at the entire housing situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comment on the item?
My name is Rob Keim. I'm the newish priest here at Arroyo Grande at St. Barnabas Episcopal Church, and I'm getting up the learning curve on what it means to live here in Arroyo Grande. I think I have a couple questions around the emergency shelter and the Five Cities Homeless Coalition. As I'm learning about our community, we seem to be gifted with some experts, some folks that really know about the complexity of the lives of our outdoor citizens or homeless folk. And they also understand what does and doesn't work in providing shelter. So my questions are whether the emergency shelter as permitted use in the IMU and HMU, was that developed with the Five Cities Homeless Coalition, or what they think about that? So those are some things that I was wondering. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. We'll answer the questions after all the comment has been heard. Are there any other comments on this particular item?
Hi, my name's Gary Axelson, and I'm a local developer. And if I could speak to the general housing, what I would consider a crisis in affordability, and to speak to what Jack was saying, we actually get an email every day of listings that are available. And I just wanted to share our perspective. You know, it's my money, and I have to pick whether I'm going to put it in the stock market or here in a piece of property, just like you would. And so you have to recognize, I think there's a huge disconnect sometimes when folks come here and they look at a developer and they automatically assume that this person's a greedy guy and there's this negative reason why he's developing a piece of property. And you just need to know, we're a family. I'm a dad, father, husband. And by the way, I build houses. And for whatever reason, if I was a farmer and we said, oh my God, we're short of corn this year, we need to make some more corn, I think everybody would embrace and want to chip in and figure out a way to help support that farmer. In fact, there's probably incentives for a farmer to grow some more corn. But so for whatever reason, for housing, we don't see that. And it's always kind of takes a negative thing. So we got to figure out. We look at a piece of property and we go, what can we do here? And you need to know, we've taken our money outside of this area. We've, part of a family business, been building here for 35 years. Built a couple thousand homes. We want to build some more houses in Rio Grande. And for whatever reason, it's not making sense right now. So you guys need to know that. So when right now it's a seller's market. So we look at a piece of property, and it's always looked at what's the best and highest use. Love to see some affordable housing, high density or whatever, but sometimes that's not the way it's sold. So sometimes the best thing is what you're seeing maybe in the village where they're putting a nice single-family home on it or something like that. But when we talk about incentives, when we talk about cooperation, when we talk about me going, you know what, I'm not going to go buy 20 lots in Bakersfield tomorrow. I want to buy 20 lots here. What level of confidence can I have to write a check for $1 million or whatever that is, that I can count on, we're going to have the support. You know, I'm not a bad guy. We're trying to help out here. Housing is a problem. And, forgive me. So anyway, I wanted to share our perspective. And you guys need to look at, why would a guy like me want to spend money here when I already want to? We just got to figure it out. I want to start that dialogue. So I'm Gary. Nice to meet you all.
Appreciate that, Gary. Would anyone else like to comment on the item?
Good evening, Mayor and fellow council members. Mike Peachy, architect with the Architectural Review Committee. I've been a member, I think it's 8 years or more, but I can't keep track. I'm very late to the game here. I know that staff has been working on the housing element for a while, and there's been some recent projects that came before the ARC the last 2 months that really piqued my interest and created some concerns for me, because I've always had a love for our community and the need for housing. I've had to deal with a housing component on many levels. As an architect, designer, I'm always trying to implement these elements that are codified, and I'm trying to apply those to a piece of property. So I'm intimate with what works and what doesn't. I'm very familiar with what developers are needing to do to build these new housing opportunities. And I'm seeing recently we have multifamily housing that have now been approved for single family, which is now putting more pressure on the affordable housing components that we're losing in our community. We're losing the ability to have, you know, more diverse in housing, like one-bedroom studios, which are for single moms or or small families or startup families. So, you know, when you talk about housing, there are so many barriers to affordable housing. It's frightening. And what you've heard other people talk about, number one on my list is the amount of regulations involved to just get a project off the boards are mind-boggling. And I've actually tried to, and you might call me crazy, do this on my own. I'm trying to do my own affordable housing project, and I'm 2 years into the project in Napomo, and I'm only at step three out of a 12-step process. So hopefully I can have a product out there in a couple of years. It's crazy. Market conditions are a huge barrier. What's driving affordable housing now is that people are making more money out of single-family housing. The density definitions of the current zoning won't allow you to provide enough units to make it desirable for a private developer to come in and build affordable housing. So now it comes down to only people that are going to do affordable housing is the nonprofits. So there's a support on the nonprofits, but you're pricing out the whole market for private developers, like the gentleman that was up here wanting to invest in his community, but he's forced to go outside the community to invest. Financing is another barrier. I've discovered that if you build more than five units, now you've got to figure out a different way to finance your project. So four-unit projects are more of the sweet spot for financing. So that's a barrier. The prior agenda item, raising the utility rates, is another barrier. I'm dealing with that as a landlord. I've got to raise rents because the water rates are going up. The sanitation rates are going up. So there are so many barriers to affordable housing. Staff has talked about parking. I've been talking with staff for the last few weeks on there are so many different ways to deal with parking that we need to implement into our ordinance. Look to San Luis Obispo. They're being creative with shared parking, car sharing, tandem, compact parking spaces, different design of parking spaces. In the big cities, they're talking about zip cars. You know, I know we're in a small community, but there is some new ideas in parking. You know, the smart cars are smaller. Why not give them credit if they bring a smart car or electric car to the project? NIMBYism is another barrier to affordable housing.
Wrap it up if you could, please.
I apologize. I'm on the ARC. We're recently looking at a project on Cherry Creek's specific plan, and I've found that the neighbors are now saying we only want those houses to be one story. That's another area that is putting pressure on affordable housing. I think we really need to look at ways to implement housing within single family that will allow a person to retire in their home, provide housing for their kids, their family, their own parents. This is one of the reasons why I bought in the Highlands, is that I wanted to have a place for my parents. If I ever needed to take care of them, I had the space. So I think the housing element needs to go further as far as how it implements definition of density. I think it needs to be increased. I think we need to eliminate the NIMBYism. And then another issue we have is in enforcement. One of the issues I have with the village is that I'm seeing, reason why people say parking's a problem is because we aren't enforcing our parking in our village. There's people that no longer are parking in their garages.
Please.
Well, this is a major issue, so I think it needs to be addressed. So this is my last item, is that we really need to look at all the ways that we can implement these items instead of just saying it on a housing element. We need to implement ideas so that we can provide affordable housing. Thank you for your time.
Would anyone else like to comment? Okay, hearing none at this time, we'll come back to the council. Okay, we'll start with Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you. Well, I am I'm supportive of staff's recommendation to go forward with the changes that staff's recommending. Kelly, could you put up the slide that was labeled, it was the beginning of the PowerPoint, the purpose of the housing element slide? Okay, there we go. Thank you. So, you know, this is a really important slide because it talks about sort of the blueprint for the housing element. And, you know, the number one, to increase the supply of housing and the mix of housing types in an equitable manner. And then to promote infill and then promote improved jobs, housing balance. And that's sort of my comments on the housing element, because I think that I really think that the attainable housing that's in the section that's in the housing element is really important. But just like Mr. Peachy mentioned, all the things that are in the housing element, you know, they all sound good on paper, and I understand why we have them, and then we move forward with the development code or the municipal code to carry them out. So it would be nice if we could really look at attainable housing and how can we really, really provide attainable housing, because I don't necessarily see the connect and then what's happening with multifamily being built with PUDs or single family. We don't really have that many vacant lots left, and so if we see that happen a lot, especially in this uptick in the housing market, I think that we're really going to have a problem seeing anything attainable for anyone, firemen, policemen, nurses, welders, plumbers that live in Arroyo Grande, that would like to live in Arroyo Grande. In the housing element, I would be in favor so that we can sort of start looking at this a lot more seriously is on the Section A.14-1, it says, what it reads now is the city shall amend the development code to include a definition of the term attainable housing, which is great. But I would go further than that, and the city shall amend the development code to define and provide incentives for attainable housing. I think that land's expensive here, and I think it's a process to go through and have something built in order for a developer to come forward and really think seriously about building studios or apartments or one bedrooms or even two bedrooms. You know, it's attached, close to each other. We really have to provide incentives, and I think that the intent is that we'd like it built, but I don't know how we entice developers to do that. Reduce processing fees, you know, parking reductions. I know that's maybe not super favorable right now. It sort of depends on the area where the land is. I know that Teresa earlier today had talked about requiring people to park in their garage, and maybe you can do that if you don't have, we have carports or we have just covered parking, because people aren't going to store things in carports. They're going to park their car in a carport. So that's a way to sort of make sure parking's used for parking and not for storing things. Attainable housing, small-scale housing, affordable by design housing, you know, isn't just good for the workforce. It's also good for seniors, and it's also good for single people and for people that could possibly are on the brink of becoming homeless, because it's smaller and so it's more affordable. Mr. Hardy brought up the fact that we have a housing crisis, and I would agree with that. It's definitely a seller's market.
Arroyo Grande is pretty built out. We don't have a lot of land that's vacant. We have a lot of infill property to build on, and that's what we're seeing come forward. We don't have a lot of in our city limits. We don't have much vacant land, large developable land available. I don't. I mean, we have our ag land, but I don't think we want to go there. So, I mean, those are basically my comments. I'm definitely in favor of what staff's proposing, but I do think that we really need to get a little bit deeper into the attainable housing part and see if we can get some developers that are interested in building something that's affordable, truly affordable, because I do think we don't have a supply of a mix of housing types for that small-scale housing. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm reminded, I reminded myself that I promised answers to questions at the end of public comment, and I recorded two. The first was any provisions for tiny houses that...
There's nothing specific to tiny houses here. I think the attainable housing item could certainly get to that. I must say I am hearing more and more interest in tiny house concepts. So, you know, perhaps there will be a market desire for something like that that, you know, will generate some projects. But the attainable housing is something that could probably help facilitate. And the densities are the densities. So whether you fit large-scale housing or maybe tiny homes with more open space, it's kind of a format of design, a very interesting one.
Thank you for that one. And the second one was about emergency shelters and coordinating that and the need for that with Five Cities Homeless Coalition or possibly HSOC.
Well, I was in conversation with Jenna Nichols, and I provided very early on a copy of the housing element and encouraged any public participation or any written comments, and I haven't received any comments to date. So we were looking at the IMU and the HMU zoning districts because of the proximity to transit. And if you're looking at you have to look at the whole zoning district, you know, and any of the other zoning districts. You know, the land availability we were looking at, and there's quite a bit of land in the IMU, you know, along there, the industrial area. But we were always open and still are open to talk to people, anybody that has comments about the choice of the IMU and the HMU or anything else, for that matter, in the housing element.
Okay, thank you again. Okay, continuing then with council comment, Mayor Pro Tem Harmon.
Thank you. First, I would like to just compliment on the excellent work on behalf of the staff. I know Consultant Wise played a part in this also. I think she's more of the state navigator and clarifying definitions and based on her expertise with, you know, working through the state. But I believe it's a really good start. There's several things I think we're all kind of selecting that could have maybe more specificity. I think you're well aware of that, and I know different trends are coming in. I just really appreciate the openness to hearing and then openness to be mindful of it when it, you know, comes across your desk, that maybe it's an opportunity. So I think that's important. I'm still very resistive to increased housing density. I think it's required to satisfy a state mandate. It seems like it's also part of the problem that we have related to balance with what we have available to develop. But the housing density still concerns me. I have concerns about the relaxed parking standards and reduced parking restrictions. I was glad to hear the different ideas related to carports and things like that. So it didn't really mean we're not going to accommodate parking. We're going to try to come up with a way that still makes it work. I'm just the negative impacts to existing neighborhoods related to parking issues are very common, very well reported, and I would just be concerned about how that would also impact commercial areas, people using parking for businesses because it's more convenient, and then impacting our businesses and things like that. I think that also related to the housing density, you know, I think if we were, you know, an urban area and there was a lot of transit opportunities, then, you know, I think that that might be a better fit for our city. So I'm still open-minded, but I'm still, I have concerns about that. Definitely encourage that anything with a high density or the parking would be developmental code, you know, amendments. So they'll be very well looked at. I would certainly want to emphasize a focus on efforts that support opportunities for housing for the disabled and any handicap and other measures, specifically that would remove constraints for housing but does not increase the cost to developers or builders. So I love the comparison. I was very much aware of the comparison related to Houston and also related to how many of our builders have gone to Kern County to build. They can get a project done, and I don't know, and you can probably correct me because you're the expert, but let's say in a two-year turnaround, and for us it's like, you know, five, you know, 10, you know, years to get in, and I'm not saying maybe us specifically, but in county in general. So what is, nobody's really talking about that, and I think Councilmember Barnidge brought that up, but nobody's really talking about, you know, $25,000 in fees just to, like, lay something on the table. Why is that? What, you know, what, that to me is a really big barrier. And, you know, the developers and builders, they know what they do, and they know how to do it right. Let's use their expertise to see what we could do, whether it's lobbying or something, to really take a look at that, and I'd be more than happy to be part of that process. I still know that we have to go through with this. We're need to follow our state law. I'm just really pleased with the document that we have, and can support the recommendations.
Councilmember Guthrie.
I too will just kind of let the cat out of the bag. I'm prepared to support this tonight. Part of the, I do think this is a sort of I hate to call it just an exercise because I recognize how much exercise it was, but that gets us sort of out of our comfort zone, and I think we're way out of our comfort zone with many things in here. We were out of our comfort zone with many things that were in the last housing element, and yet most of them didn't come to pass. Almost none of them did. So it's we put a lot of possibilities in here in the hopes that one of them will actually work out in the marketplace. I think that speaks to what I think is the general issue, is that at the end of the day, what drives housing is the market. We can put in all the density in here we want, but at the end of the day, what's going to sell and what's going to get built is what's going to sell, and what's going to sell is probably not going to take advantage of the full densities that are in here. And I know I talked about this 10 years ago, whether we should have minimum densities, and we did attempt to go there, and just got so much pushback that we were, at least at that time, were unable to have fixed densities. I do want to speak to the sort of the overall picture about why we have, and it's limited constraint. We just have constraints. There's not enough water to build 2,000 units anywhere near Arroyo Grande, and that's the kind of housing growth that we would need to see to even begin to keep up. And so there's that kind of a constraint. There's the traffic constraints, which frankly often are tied to NIMBY issues, but they are in fact there as well. So I think that when we want to have this conversation, and you know, let's talk about the other sort of elephant in the room, and that's things like Prop 13 that make it very difficult to develop the services that are necessary for housing once it gets built. So. So I think when we speak to the much bigger picture of housing, that we have to be honest that's what's limiting housing in our areas. It really is resource constrained, and as much as we go out and develop new water sources, they get used up by droughts that make us question whether we really have them. I'll use San Luis Obispo as an example, as a community that is, over the last 15 years, has gone out and just built up a bunch of resources. They have water resources like nobody else has, and yet they have people telling them, oh, you need to stop building because you don't have the water, when they've built huge buffers. So I do think that those kinds of questions take a commitment, not just by the council, but by community in general, that we're all going to get together and bear the burden of developing other resources that maybe we're not going to use. And that's really what the conversation that has to take place. That's the difficult conversation. It's got nothing to do with what we establish here as densities. Every once in a while, one of these densities will come through. I think we saw that at Pike and Elm, that somebody actually finds a way to make it work, and then barely. I mean, So I did want to speak to that overall resource constraint. I'm not quite sure where the valley continues to get the massive amounts of water and those kinds of things in their communities as well. But they do seem to have a lot more of that resource available, or at least did. I have one other point I wanted to make. Oh, and this has to do with what we call workforce housing, you know, how we define workforce. Some people are treating workforce housing as if rental housing is workforce housing, and that is one piece of it. But generally, when we're talking about workforce housing, we're talking about home ownership. And that is, that's just, in my mind, just one piece of it. The fact that we recently built the first market-rate apartment building in 20 years, I think, is significant. It's driven by a whole bunch of things. It's just not a great investment. It's a very difficult investment. You have to almost just that's what you do, as opposed to you really look at it as most development would, is what's the most profitable. And finally, I want to speak to what's going to be another driving force, and that is the competition, if you will, between residential uses and commercial zones. I do think that's the direction that we have to go, that's going to be the case here. But we do have to be careful that we maintain enough commercial space to one, provide services to those people, and we then are going to be looking at some different revenue source than simple retail sales tax to fund the services that are necessary. And I'll comment on one last thing. I was hoping to find it here, but one of the things that struck me here in looking at some of this, one of the things that's great about this is all the stats that are in it, and I'm just stunned by this, that 25% of the households in Arroyo Grande are over $100,000. I just wasn't ready for that, and it's by far the biggest sector in our community, but it's also the one that's grown the most in the last 10 years. I think, you know, when we look at that, that's what's driving housing costs is the incomes in our community. Thank you.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you. I just want to make a few comments because there's all been a lot of talk about this already. This is an exercise in bureaucracy. That's what this document is. It's something we have to do. The real question is, what do we do where the rubber meets the road in terms of development in Arroyo Grande? Your questions and your concerns were brought up, and that's the $64,000 question. And so we talk about the fact that businesses say that doing business in Arroyo Grande is difficult, and we need to streamline how business is done. And I don't mean development business, just regular people trying to open a business. And that same sort of philosophy should apply to development. We should maybe blow the whole thing up and start over. I don't know if we can be incremental or not. I don't know the answer. I don't have an answer off the top of my head. But I will tell you a few things. One is, as Mr. Guthrie said, and partly based on income, but in large part based on where we live, I disagree with the idea that if we built 1,000 units of housing stock, that all of a sudden things are going to become more affordable. We don't live in Bakersfield, thank God. Okay? You build 1,000 units in Bakersfield, they're going to have a different value than 1,000 units on the coast. I don't care what you do. It's just the reality. So it's mostly market-driven. And I understand that developers need to make it pencil out. So to the sense that we can help on the penciling out of, you know, development fees or whatever it is, I get that, and I appreciate that. But let's not fool ourselves and say, oh, we need to build 1,000 units and everything's going to be good in Arroyo Grande, because it's not. We're going to have 1,000 more people here that have good incomes, that have come from L.A. or San Francisco or somewhere else and said, this is where I want to retire, this is where I want to be, and they're going to be houses I won't be able to afford, and I've been here a long time. So let's not fool ourselves that building a ton of units is going to resolve the problem, because it's not. We just have to come to grips with the fact that we live in a beautiful place and that has a cost. I also want to bring up the idea of infrastructure. We are running out of buildable land in the current city of Arroyo Grande. So the question is, what do we do now? So the natural progression would be to move south over the Fredericks property and the Williams property. That's been discussed before. And the big bugaboo there was Caltrans said, you know what? If you want to do that development you're talking about, you're going to have to put in a freeway interchange. And back then it was going to cost $3 million. God only knows what it would cost now. And the parties that be said, we're not doing it. And they wanted the city to pay for that part of it. And we were like, no way. You got to figure out a way to make it work. And the reality was, there was a way to make it work. It's called a self-assessment district. All they had to do was set up an assessment district, and they could have paid for the whole thing and had it built. And we'd have it built there today. But the developer at that time said, no, I'm not doing it. And Mr. Hardy, I appreciate you so much, but I'll argue the water issue with you till the cows come home, because I happen to believe that farming, in some instances, what you say is true, and some it's not. And the other thing I'd like to tell you about farming in general is it's a community asset that this community has determined they value. So you can't just look at it from the point of, we're going to plow over the farmland because we can save water and build houses. Arroyo Grande has made a conscious effort to say the 300 acres that we have within the city of Arroyo Grande are worth preserving. We're not saying fill in those 300 acres and leave all the farming out in the county. We've said we value those 300 acres. So that's a community choice, and that can't be ignored. Maybe the community changes and moves away from that. But as of now, and for a very long time, that's been an issue of value. So that has to be part of the calculation as well. So I'm more interested in not this document. I think they did a fine job. It's, you know, they've had a lot of practice at it. The last one just got certified 2 years ago. It's like they might as well just never take it off their desk, because they're going to have to start on it tomorrow. Okay? It's just like, let's put a new date on it and start over. The real question becomes, how do we implement the things that we want to get accomplished? And what are those things? And so when I hear you say you can build 200,000 units or whatever in Houston, it's probably flatter than a pancake. They got all kinds of income there. They got all kinds of water there. They got things that we don't have. We're dealing with topography, we're dealing with all kinds of things. So I sympathize with the dilemma, and I do think there's things we can do. I absolutely do think there's things we can do to improve the development side of the equation. But I just don't want us to live in some fantasy land that if we build 1,000 units that, oh my God, you know, our kids are going to be able to live here. They're not going to be able to live here unless they're making $150,000, $200,000 a year. Based on housing prices. That's just the reality. It's just, to say anything else that isn't rational, because housing prices, as you know, keep going up just because it's a great place to live. It's not just an issue of housing stock. So I apologize for my soapbox. I'll get off it now. But I feel really strongly about that. I've had a number of developers that are friends of mine and people that talk to me about the arduousness of the process of going through Arroyo Grande for development. And that's why I say maybe we need to blow the whole process up. Maybe. If we can do it in such a manner that still keeps the essence of what Arroyo Grande is about. It has to do both those things. It has to do both. And I don't pretend to have the answer off the top of my head. I could say a few things that would be probably highly unpopular, and I'm not about to say them out loud at this point, but there are some things we could probably do. But that's a discussion we're going to have at a later date, so I'm ready to move forward.
Okay, I appreciate all the public comment. I also want to thank the staff for the effort on this. This is a major deal that's required by the state on a 5 or, if you're lucky, a 7-year increment, but it's something that a process that they have to go through. It has to be certified, so it has to be done right. And kudos to the staff for your efforts on this. This has brought up a number of issues that most of my colleagues have touched on, and Mr. Axelson's comments and Mr. Hardy's comments I think are spot on. One of the comments that was made had to do with, well, I could put my money in the stock market, or I could put my money in making widgets. Economists would call that opportunity cost, and that's the difference in profitability from building houses, as it were, to making widgets or whatever else you might want to do with your money. And that's a real part of it. What another quote from Mr. Axelson is, for whatever reason. Well, there's a whole ton of reasons, I think, as we've worked through, and identifying each of those reasons, I think, is helpful. We need to look at our regulations, which drive up cost. We need to look at our requirements, which drive up cost. We need to look at the various things that tend to drive up cost. So I think there are some things that we can do to streamline processes and hopefully lower some costs. Counter to that is concern about resources that was brought up. I'll concede the point that perhaps agricultural land uses more water than housing. I think what Arroyo Grande is looking at, rather than conversion of ag land for the most part, is infill. And infill, in my view, is land that's using zero water today. So any housing that goes on infill, and if you're talking about high density on infill, you're talking about increased water use, in my view. So I don't see infill development as anything but probably requiring more water, which is something that we're learning that we have less of all the time. So that's a concern. Another concern is residential fundamentally doesn't pay the freight. And I am also concerned that our industrial and our commercial zones are being taken over by high-density residential. And probably the higher the density, the more services that are going to be needed, but don't contribute economically, really, to pay the cost of services that are required for that. So these are competing things, a list of problems, some things we can address. What I would like to see is a citywide discussion on this and other topics. Lay it out. Have everybody come together. Provide your thoughts. Where do we want to go as a city? So I guess I'm asking for a citywide goal setting. What do we want to look like? Because we're kind of at a crossroads here. In my view, and these kind of documents tend to just prod us a little bit toward that day. And I think what we need to have is the maximum of public input to figure out where we want to go as a city. And I think we need to look into facilitating those kinds of discussions in the near term on not only housing but other things. What kind of commercial development do we want? Where do we want it? How much ag land are we willing to give up? What water resources are we willing to pay for? There's some options. Desal's been talked about. Recycled water's been talked about. other things. What are we going to do to get the resources? Because especially if it comes to infill development, I'm looking at, it appears to me that it's going to take more water, not less. So I think we need a citywide, community-wide discussion on these kinds of topics. So that's my soapbox part. And with that, I am prepared to support this and move forward. I know that it's a requirement. And again, my sincere thanks to the staff for working through it all with us.
Mr. Mayor, I would move approval of a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande approving General Plan Amendment 14-002 and adopting an initial study negative deck housing element update for the 2014 through 2019 regional housing needs assessment cycle with the proposed changes from staff, and that the item A.14-1 read, the city shall amend the development code to define and provide incentives for attainable housing.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. May we have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Yes.
Mayor Hill?
Yes.
Do we also have an ordinance to introduce?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would move an approval of an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande amending Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding emergency shelters and supportive and transitional housing.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we adopt the ordinance as recommended.
That would be introduction. This is
an
introduction.
So an introduction of an ordinance. So you want me to read it again?
No.
Okay.
And have we read the title of the ordinance? Great. Okay, may we have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes. Old business, we have none. New business, we have none. Item 13 is council reports. The South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. We moved to appoint a new general manager for the sanitation district. That appointment will be made at our next meeting, is anticipated. We also have to report that one of the legal action sanitation district was involved in, which was an action of the sanitation district versus the Special Districts Risk Management Association. That legal action has been adjudicated in the favor of the Special Districts Risk Management Association. The meaning of that is that the sanitation district had sought to recover the cost of litigation against the State Water Board and Regional Water Quality Control Board, and effectively that action has been disapproved by the court. So the sanitation district will not have access to recovery of the funds spent on litigation in the State Water Board matter. The sanitation district board is now considering options to deal with that going forward. We also, for everyone's information, proposed and passed a rate increase. The rate increase will be from approximately $15 a month to approximately $25 a month over the course of 5 years. The money will be used to expand supplement the secondary treatment part of the process at the sanitation district plant. The sanitation district plant does a two-part process before the processed water is discharged into the ocean. The first part of the process has got two components that are fully interchangeable. So one part of the process can be taken out of service for maintenance and so forth, and the other part of the process will continue on. The secondary treatment portion of the plant process is a single train process consisting of what's called a fixed film reactor and a secondary clarifier. Both of those are single pieces of equipment that have no redundant backup. The fixed film reactor's been in service for 30 years. If that piece of that's the equipment that has a big tank that has a sprayer on the top of it that sprays down over filter media. If that piece of equipment were to fail, and again it's run continuously for 30 years, the plant would immediately be out of its discharge requirements and would no longer meet the discharge license. So the proposal is to install a parallel secondary treatment path. Part of the reason for that is the state license, again, is being, the license requirement for discharge is being tightened up. The amounts of material in the discharge stream is being reduced under the license. And in order to meet that, the current plant equipment is not capable of meeting that in all conditions. And therefore, we would, if the new license goes into effect, the plant will occasionally be out of compliance. Out of compliance means fines. And so we're proposing to install a parallel portion of the secondary treatment at the plant that will enable us to meet the discharge requirements under all conditions going forward. In the event that recycled water, which is something that is on the horizon for Pismo Beach, is certainly moving forward in the direction of recycled water. All of the cities in what's called the Northern Cities Management Area, which includes Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, Oceano Community Services District, and the city of Pismo Beach, are holding discussions about the potential for recycled water, what the costs would be, what the locations would be, what the treatment process would be, and so forth, what the cost would be, how those costs would be allocated. But even in the event, in order for the South San Luis treatment plant to provide reliable feedstock, if you will, to a final treatment plant such as being discussed for recycled water, that process has to be fully treated to the secondary treatment process. And so the redundant portion of the system that we're being proceeding with developing will assure that that water process will meet not only the discharge requirements should we continue to discharge into the ocean, but we'll also be able to meet the requirements of influent for a plant that would provide further treatment for recycled use. So that comes, of course, at a cost, and that is why the rate increase is going into effect.
It was 15 to 20 per month for the rate increase?
15 to 25,
okay.
Approximately, yeah. In round numbers over a five-year period.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Briscoe Halcyon Interchange Subcommittee has not met. The Oversight Board has not met. CJPIA has announced a meeting down in Southern California. I don't believe I will be able to attend that. So that is all I have to report. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. The County Water Resource Advisory Committee met on March 2nd. That meeting's focus was on a work program
related to work program priorities and the approach to developing the flood control and water conservation districts for fiscal year 2016-17. These districts are also related to the sustainable groundwater management districts that are all being looked at as another state requirement. The Water Resource Division's goal is to achieve sustainable water resources for all areas of the county and determine how to utilize existing resources to achieve these goals and identify needs or gaps in resources. So that's a really big project. There's a whole division now devoted to that with the county. So I'll keep everyone informed as that process moves forward. The Five Cities Fire Authority did the meeting for March was canceled, so I'll have a full report at the end of next month. And then the Air Pollution Control District Board meets again at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, so I will report out at the end of April related to any outcomes from that meeting. That's it.
Councilmember Guthrie.
So starting with San Luis, I've already reported on what would have been this month's meeting that in fact the board did support us on Briscoe, and I believe that's gone forward to this day, but I don't think we've heard back yet. South County Transit has not met. The Tourism Committee meets on Monday. As noted, Halcyon Subcommittee has not met. And then I did attend the EBC meeting for Councilmember Brown. There was a really great discussion on the I've forgotten which name of the ranch it is there in the southwest part of, I think it is Edna Ranch. Edna Ranch in the southwest part of San Luis Obispo, and their decision to, as we discussed here, to put in housing and take out some of the commercial. Some members of the EDC expressed concern about that. And that was then followed by a very interesting discussion about the fees for commercial properties in San Luis Obispo and how restrictive they are. And it was a very timely discussion to some of the things we're talking about tonight. So that's the report on that. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Councilmember Brown.
Okay, so Integrated Waste Management met, and main issue of discussion was the medicine take-back program that started September 1st, 2015. Currently, there's 45 pharmacies in San Luis Obispo County that are doing take-back of unwanted medicine. The California Board of Pharmacy has issued draft regulations that would make it more restrictive and burdensome, and if that takes place, all those take-back programs are going to shut down. So there's competing bills. One is SB 1229 by Senator Jackson to undo that and keep it viable, and there's another Assembly Bill 45 by Member Mullen that's in competition, basically making it so arduous to make it not acceptable. So that we sent a letter saying that we were for one and against the other. The only other things we really talked about were grant applications, the typical grant applications that are put in, and also the fact that Bill Worrell had his name again on the standard textbook for waste management, which he's quite proud of, and deservedly so. Excuse me. Thanks to Jim for covering EVC. I believe I handled the HSOC for Kristen, right?
The one, yeah, I have one to report on, but you went to the one before.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you went to, it was an ad hoc.
I went to a special, that's right, it was an ad hoc meeting. So basically, I would tell you it was an exercise in frustration for me. I saw a number of well-meaning people sit around a table and argue about the barriers to warming shelters, which we'd already talked about, but more importantly, they talked a lot about the money that the supervisors had allocated for that purpose, and it turns out that the committee really has no control over where that money goes. The county administrator makes the decision. So there was a lot of discussion and disbelief in the room that why are we sitting around here telling you that we're committed to this and we don't really seem to have control over this money. So it was kind of discouraging, quite honestly. And it also showed to me that there still is some sort of lack of cohesiveness on how to deal with the homeless problem in San Luis County. And there's many different facets to it, so that's part of it. Different types of, the big thing that they talked about was the different types of homelessness, because you can't lump everybody into the same type of homelessness environment. So you have to have different solutions for the different folks. But so that's my report. I don't have anything else to report on, Mr. Mayor.
The issue of expired pharmaceuticals and disposition of that is, I think, of keen interest, and it's possibly something that the council may consider sending a letter of support in terms of SB 1229, if that's the one that makes it easier for pharmacies to continue to accept expired prescription drugs. Formerly, fire stations were authorized to accept expired prescription drugs. The state law was changed, or the federal law won. Fire stations are no longer able to do that. Only pharmacies currently are able to take back expired prescription drugs. And one of the major issues is that the more difficult you make it to turn in expired prescription drugs, people tend to dump it down the drain, which is one of the worst things you can do in terms of the sanitation district plant, for example. If you're talking about antibiotics, this is a biotic treatment plant, and therefore the dumping antibiotics into the mix can adversely affect the treatment plant, and we can have weird chemicals coming out in the effluent from the treatment plant. So I would strongly urge anyone who's listening tonight, please do not dump expired drugs and those sorts of things down the drain. The drain is for wastewater only, not chemicals and not medicines. And I think it's to the advantage of the community that we do everything we possibly can to make it easier for people to dispose of those types of items in a safe and sane manner. So that would be something that I would think the council might want to endorse.
I'd like to support that. Maybe the first thing to do, though, is have Diane talk to Bill Worrell. He's a really great guy. I don't know if you've met him, but he's really a kick. You really like talking to him. He's more passionate about sewage than anybody I know, or waste, you know, waste than anybody I know. So, before we jump to that step of writing a letter, maybe just ask him what would be most helpful. Because he really is doing the letter on behalf of all the jurisdictions in the county already. So just a thought.
Good. Thank you for that. Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you. Yes, the Homeless Services Oversight Council met on March 16th. We voted to approve Jana Nichols for appointment to the HSOC, so that was good. Just some a good person to sit on the HSOC and weigh in on some decisions we're making regarding the homeless. She helps with the warming shelter here, or she actually does the warming shelter here in AG. We had nominations and elections for various leadership positions. I don't know how I ended up with the vice chair seat, because I was actually there, and that usually goes to someone who doesn't show up, but that happened. We voted to approve the housing options presentation developed by members of the HSOC Housing Committee. That was what Jerry Rio presented to us tonight. They're going to take that on the road to the various municipalities to try to open up the discussion about other ways of housing vulnerable people that are on the verge of homelessness, some creative ideas. Mayor Martin from Paso Robles gave a short summary of what they are doing to clean up the Salinas Riverbed. I'm sure you saw that all in the paper. And here's some pictures I'll share, some before and afters. There in Paso Robles, there's 200 to 400 unhoused people, 45 to 90 were in the riverbed. Paso Cares is a nonprofit that has warming shelters open, I believe, almost every night at different venues in Paso. They had a study session. Paso City Council had a study session on homelessness, and they had a unanimous vote of the council to allocate $69,000 from the general fund to clean up and relocate the people that were living in the Salinas Riverbed. Plus, they also allocated $10,000 of that to be used for housing vouchers, but apparently no one's taken them up on that yet. The most exciting thing that he brought up is that Paso is investigating possibly using the state-owned California Youth Authority property in Paso Robles for some sort, and this is very, very preliminary, but apparently, I don't know a lot about the property, but it's vacant or mostly vacant, and so Mayor Martin's idea is, can we have a Beyond Homelessness campus? I mean, that's just... So obviously just sort of brainstorming that, talking to the state, people brought up, would that be tiny homes? Would that be like the some of the camps or we've seen in Portland? And he wasn't sure. He just said that he was happy that the discussion was happening and that they were possibly open to that or at least discussing it. So that's something that we might... move a little bit more forward, and so that was a new development that people at the HSOC were encouraged, especially for the North County homeless. Zone 3 met, and the Lopez Lake is at 14,611 acre feet. It's at 30% capacity. Unfortunately, only 1 to 2% higher than January. Even though we've had a lot of rain, obviously the ground was pretty dry, so a lot of it soaked in. John Lindsay apparently is predicting a wet April. So, the update on the desal plant went to the Board of Supervisors this morning. I know we had an email that part of it was approved. We saw from Mr. Brad Snook. I reached out and didn't get an answer on exactly what was approved, but what was before the board were four key items: budget, water agreement with PG&E, reimbursement agreements with the partners, and the CEQA permitting process. And recommendations in the staff report were receive and file a Diablo Canyon Power Plant desal hydraulic feasibility analysis, number one. Number two, direct staff to engage the Pacific Gas and Electric Company to establish a water supply agreement for a term not less than 30 years or the financing period of project financing sources, whichever is less. Direct staff to continue to engage stakeholders in the flood control district zone 3, which is five cities in the Avila Beach areas and includes Arroyo Grande, regarding all phases of the project development, including timelines, costs, financing, water supply, amounts, and conditions, and establish a conditional reimbursement agreement. Number four, direct staff to initiate the scoping and consultant selection portions of the environmental review and permitting phase of the project by initiating the CEQA process. Include ongoing consultation with the California Coastal Commission, State Water Resources Control Board, and the Regional Water Quality Board. Direct staff to return to the board with an executed water supply agreement, conditional reimbursement agreements, and a CEQA consultant agreements before proceeding further, and then authorize a budget adjustment in the amount of $900,000 from the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation Reserves. I will obviously we probably read about that, but I will get the information for next time that I report out from Zone 3. Let's make sure. Let's see. Yep, I think that was all. Thank you.
A question on the Paso Robles repurposing the CYA facility. Mayor Martin's made that presentation. That facility includes food service, locations as well as medical facilities, and the state is currently paying money to maintain it vacant.
Mm-hmm.
And so the repurposing of that facility for a Beyond Homelessness campus sounds to me to be a great idea that takes and repurposes an existing structure. Mayor Martin is asking for letters of support. He's actually drafting up a letter of support and is asking for signatures from mayors of the cities in the county. And so I would like to get an idea, if possible, if the sense of the council, if there's support for signing such a letter, if that's...
Sure.
It would be asking the mayor to do that. But
you're asking to have that brought back on a future agenda for you all to chime in on that.
We could certainly do that.
Or can we just
do it now?
It's not on your agenda this evening.
It's not on the agenda.
I really don't see how we can do that.
I would support.
Mm-hmm. When's the letter going out?
He's drafted it, but it's not... I don't think it's ready to be sent quite yet.
It'd be great if we could get a copy of the letter and put it on agenda for you all to vote on.
Sounds good.
Could it be a consent item?
We could do that.
Could it be a consent item?
Could certainly be.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay. Any other council communications?
None for me.
I just wanted to mention we had looked at a community service grant for the Family Care Network when we looked at those. I think that was last meeting. It's the apartment complex that we gave or that we helped them buy a cluster mailbox a couple years ago on Elm and just a little bit past the dog park on your left. And that... that nonprofit Family Care Network takes kids that are growing out of the foster care system, and they live there and helps them get jobs, etc. And anyway, they wanted to do a landscape project, and the Aroy Grinding Bloom and the Tree Guild are going to go ahead and help them with that, so they can do hopefully almost all they wanted to do at lowered cost to them.
Only that I'm ready for bed.
Okay, that. So much for council communications. Is there any other public comment? Okay, hearing none. We have no closed session to report. And with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.